Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is September 7th, 2014, and this is episode 63. I have dreamed a dream. 15 years of the Sega Dreamcast. Welcome once again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
As you likely gathered from that episode title, this week we're going to be celebrating the 15th anniversary of the North American release of the Sega Dreamcast, which notably released on November 9th, 1999.
9999!
Exactly so, Slagkick. But before we really get to talking about that, I want to follow up with our usual follow-ups and news bits, as we always do. Slaggy McWaggy, if you'd like to kick us off here.
Yes, Nipponichi Software announced, as you know, that we are going to be seeing more Disgaea 5 coming soon. They have also talked about the fact that it's going to have the most volume of any game in the series.
Which is nuts.
Yeah, because, you know, thousands of levels already.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is already the kind of game that you can easily pump a few thousand hours into, like, every iteration of these games. The idea that Disgaea 5 is going to have the most, like, volume of content is effing nuts to me.
And we've found out, thanks to Game Joho, that the protagonist is named Kilia, a young demon boy who swears to get a revenge against the demon emperor Void Dark. And the heroine named Seraphine is a demon lord of the gorgeous underworld. Hi.
Yeah,
yes.
Right? Supposedly, an upcoming issue of Dengeki PlayStation is going to have a product code for some kind of teaser for the game.
A playable teaser?
I certainly hope so. Disgaea 5 PT.
Oh, no.
In any event, we are sure to hear a whole lot more about Disgaea 5. This is one of my favorite series of games, and, you know, we should have a ton of information on it in the next few weeks. Please look forward to it. We also have word here that the upcoming revival of the Alone in the Dark series, this is Alone in the Dark Illumination, is currently slated for a November release on PC. You know, that's kind of actually really surprising because this game was announced not that long ago, and apparently it's already going to be releasing pretty quickly. So, you know, please look forward to that. We also have word here that Guilty Gear Xrd Sign has a new character on the way. This is going to be for the PlayStation 3 and PlayStation 4 home ports, and it's going to be the first DLC character for the game. Her name is Elfert, and she is going to be an elfin girl gunner. Her release details are that she will be free as bonus DLC for people who get first print copies of the game in Japan, and she'll be purchasable after that window for 800 yen, or what, you know, like $7.75 or something.
LOL.
Yeah. We also have word, and this is actually really, really exciting, that Mighty No. 9's beta has started. You may recall that Mighty No. 9 had a Kickstarter done last year, and that $80 tier of support was for a pre-release beta participation key. That has gone live. If you were a Mighty No. 9 backer and you haven't gotten into this yet, be sure to check your email for a code on Steam to redeem in order to get access to the early access beta for Mighty No. 9.
And it also notes that backers will receive a free copy of Mighty Gunvolt.
Oh, excellent. That's great. That's just a real, like, bonus. I wasn't expecting that.
Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo Revival, which was a Game Boy Advance port that had some differences because, you know, it was on the GBA. It had some different stages. It had to be adapted to the GBA's control scheme and had Shin Akuma as a playable character. Anyways, this is coming to the Wii U Virtual Console. We got news of this from the Australia Classification Board.
LOL, once again.
And because Wii U is the only one that really ports Virtual Console for GBA, that's probably where it's going.
You know, this is surprising to me because, and you know, look, I'm trying to be civil here, but this game is a mess. Like, this port of Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo is awful. You know, they did downscale the control scheme to work on GBA since it only has four buttons. But there are other issues, such as if you get to the game and unlock Akuma, you know, as a fight where, you know, he comes out and beats up Bison, you know, which is what happened in Super Turbo, the game will actually freeze on you. Like, they literally didn't bug test that hidden fight, and
Oops.
If you access it, the game will crash. So, like, this port, it's just a mess. And to me, this really speaks to Capcom's desperation to get everything out on the digital channels as possible for a profit.
Yeah.
It's good because we spent the whole first 2 years of this show hoping for Capcom to get all of their retro titles available on these channels so that we could enjoy them. But I guess the downside is that means we're going to get some stinkers like this.
Oops, poops.
We also have a very, very exciting story here. Sony has filed in Europe to renew the trademark on VibRibbon.
What?
So we don't really know anything more than that. Certainly this might have nothing to do with a new release or a re-release, and it might just be them keeping their options open for the future. But as far as VibRibbon goes, especially with, we had many VibRibbon teases during the E3 conference this year, which we complained about, during the Sony Computer Entertainment ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, one of their main speaking people in their staff was wearing a VibRibbon shirt that was like new that no one had ever seen before. So, there's definitely some VibRibbon teases out there.
Maybe the trademark's just for VibRibbon merchandise.
The thing is, as awful as that would be, I'd still be happy with it because I love Vibri, and I would love to have, like a shirt with a little Vibri popping out like...
Pretty much.
So, excellent. Please look forward to that. Slaggy, I think you might like to take this one.
Yes, there was a super fierce, or should I say, yes! There was a super fierce Bayonetta Direct a couple days ago, and we already knew that there were going to be Princess Peach, Samus, and Link costumes for the Wii U port of Bayonetta, and when we watched the Direct, we found out that these costumes will be available in Bayonetta 2 as well, along with a Bayonetta 2 exclusive Fox McCloud costume that actually looks way more couture than you would expect.
Yeah, it really does.
And I am so much hyped for Bayonetta, not just because of these costumes, but, like, it looks so good. It's going to be out on October 24th, as we previously reported, and I need it right now. It looks even more over the top and sexy and fierce than the first game, which was already all of those things.
Right? And I'm excited to see, that these extra costumes are going to be playable in Bayonetta 2, aside from the Fox McCloud one, which is going to be exclusive to Bayonetta 2. I also was happy to see that the Daisy costume was finally confirmed. Because, a lot of us...
Hi, I'm Daisy.
A lot of us had noted in the various trailers, like, oh, there's an icon for Daisy. Why haven't they shown us the Daisy costume? But they have now. Either way, yeah. One of my most hyped games of the year. Cannot wait. If Bayonetta 2 lives up to the first game, this, I'm calling it now, is going to end up being the Game Buoy Game of the Year 2014.
Game Buoy Game of the Year 2014.
In other news, the King of Fighters rhythm game spinoff for mobile, Rhythm of Fighters, is price dropping to be a free game.
Oops.
For those of you like myself, this is a good thing. For those of you like myself who paid to buy this game, we're going to be being compensated with 5 free songs to download for the game. So this is actually really exciting. Rhythm of Fighters was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. I talked about that here on the show. I was really surprised by how much fun it was. And especially now that it's free, I can't recommend highly enough just giving it a shot if you have a compatible mobile phone.
Okay.
We also have here a release date for Mortal Kombat X, or Cross. Was that Cross?
I don't remember.
It's X or Cross. It's not 10. I know that. in any event, it's going to be releasing on April 14th, and Goro is going to be a pre-order bonus. Which is, of course, very exciting, those of you who have been following the Mortal Kombat series for a long time probably remember the four-armed Goro as the boss, mid-boss, from Mortal Kombat 1.
Yeah.
He's been sort of like one of the iconic characters of the series, I would say. So it's exciting, to have him as a playable character, and even though he is a download character, he'll be free for, pre-orders, so that's cool.
Yeah, I was just thinking about Goro in the film.
Oh, hell, that's not a good thing. We also have here, in Smash Brothers news, the announcement of a very exciting game mode. This is called the All-Star Mode.
Hey now, you're an All-Star.
And Masahiro Sakurai-san explained how the mode works over on Miiverse. Quote unquote, this time you can challenge every fighter in All-Star mode from the moment you turn on the game. This is a survival battle with limited recovery items and no option to continue. However, this mode will be incomplete until you've unlocked every fighter. Until then, you can only play against characters that are already available.
Cool.
Yeah, so I think that's really exciting. I think this is a really cool mode. You know, we've heard from Nintendo and specifically from Sakurai-san himself about how he didn't just want to do another Subspace Emissary. He wanted to sort of experiment in the single-player modes and do different ideas. And I'm looking at the graphic that they posted on Miiverse for this, where it's almost like a little timeline of when all of these characters originated by year as you fight them. So like, yeah, it has like a little 1980 for Pac-Man, and an 81 for Mario and DK, and an 83 for Luigi, and an 84 for Little Mac. I just think that's a really cool way to present this data.
Yeah.
And to give players an appreciation for the history of these characters.
I definitely agree, and I notice on the other screenshot, like, it's 1991 to 93, and it has Sonic, Kirby, King Dedede, Fox McCloud, and Meta Knight.
Yeah, like, dude, isn't that, I think that's rad. I'm really excited.
He even says, behold, the history of Nintendo games.
I love it. You know, and a little bit of a sad note here, this might be our last Smash news, for the 3DS version, at least. The 3DS version of Smash Brothers launches in Japan this week. The good news, of course, is that those of you who want to hear about our impressions of Smash Brothers 3DS, we will have some of those for you on our next episode. Please look forward to it. But in terms of news, until we start getting more information about the Wii U version, this might, you know, we might be looking at sort of a little bit of a news update drought for a little while.
Aww.
Yeah. And last, but certainly not least, for our follow-ups, we have word here that Destiny can now be preloaded. That, of course, won't help you too much. When this episode goes live, the game will probably already be out. But if we get it up early and you haven't preloaded yet, go preload. Servers will be going live at 3 a.m. Eastern, 12 midnight Pacific. So.
Works for you.
It sure does. And I tell you, I already have this game preloaded, and if the servers are alright, tomorrow night, I very likely will take a half day on Tuesday so I can play all
Well, I hope that, none of your bosses or anything listen to this.
Yeah, I'm not gonna call in and be like, oh, I'm sick. I'm just gonna be like, I need a few hours of personal time, but I'll be in at noon. Peace. I ain't gonna lie. Anyway, enough about that. It's time for some news.
News. Oh my god. News. So Bungie dropped a little bomb on us by announcing that if you buy one of the last gen versions of Destiny for a limited time, you will get the next gen digital version for free. That means if you have the PS3 version digitally, you will get the PS4 version digitally. And if you buy the 360 version digitally, you will get the Xbox One version digitally. You will be able to keep all of your
Guardians and progress and stats and gear.
And you'll be able to keep licenses for both titles.
Yeah, you'll get to keep it both for the PlayStation 3 version and the PlayStation 4 version, or 360 and Xbox One if that's the console family you're on.
Now, it is important to note that you can't cross console, so you can't upgrade from PS3 to Xbox One or from 360 to PS4.
Yeah, but if you're in the PlayStation family and you go from one console to the other, that is acceptable, and the same with Xbox. And this promotion is going to be running until January 15th. So they're actually people, yeah, a good like 3 months to take advantage here.
Oh, you know, I have been reading about that, and a lot of analysts, aka people on the internet, seem to think it's just because of the holiday time and people being hopeful for new consoles.
Well, I mean, and that's the perfect way to do it. If you think you're going to be getting a new console at, you know, Christmas or whatever, then a lot of people previously might have been like, well, I might as well wait until Christmas to see if I get a new console. And now you don't have to. If you're still on last gen, and that's totally cool, you can, you know, buy this game on PS3 or 360, and once you get your new console, you can just upgrade and take your character with you.
Yeah.
So I think that's really cool. I love that they're giving it such a large window to take advantage of this promotion. I hope we see more of this. I think it's great.
Yeah. We got an interesting little RPG tidbit. For those of you who are familiar with Popo Le Croix, a manga series that was pretty popular back in the, you know, 90s.
Yeah, the Popo Le Croix manga was a big deal back in the 90s. And, you know, there was actually an exclusive PlayStation 1 series of JRPGs. I don't think that any of them came over to the US until, like, the Vita one. But, you know, this is actually, like, kind of a big deal that this is actually a game that's coming to 3DS.
Yeah. So anyway, they're going to be teaming up with Marvelous to create Popolocroy Bokujo Monogatari. So it's a crossover between Harvest Moon, a.k.a. Story of Seasons, a.k.a. Farm Story, a.k.a. Bokujo Monogatari. And so it'll be kind of based on the characters from the Popolocroy series, and it'll involve RPG battles and a farm. I have to say, after doing all the farm stuff in Mists of Pandaria, I'm really into farms.
Excellent, yeah.
But not Farmville.
The funny thing about you saying that way is that the WoW farms are very similar specifically to Farmville.
I know.
Like, if you're looking for a more pure farming experience, I would probably recommend, like, the SNES era Harvest Moons.
Yeah.
You should look into that. I believe they're on eShop. In any event, really excited for this game. We'll probably in the future just be referring to it as Popolocroy Farm Story, because, you know, we certainly don't want to deal with the tongue twister that is Bokujo Monogatari, but, you know, really excited for this game. Big fan of both of these franchises, so it'll be exciting to see how this plays out.
Let's just call it Popo Farm.
Popo Farm!
Like Popozelle.
Yes! We also have word here from Yoshinori Ono-san over at Capcom that the company is recruiting new workers to develop, in conjunction with Dimps, a new fighting game.
Interesting.
It has specifically been called out by Ono-san as a next-generation fighting game. Ono-san has expressed an interest in reviving Darkstalkers. We've talked about that here on the show quite a few times. And it is worth mentioning, you know, that Dimps actually worked with Capcom on Street Fighter IV, as well as Street Fighter Cross Tekken. So,
that's true.
You know, I know initially some people who didn't realize that saw that they were working with Dimps and were like, really? Capcom's outsourcing? But this is actually great news. I think Dimps has done a tremendous job working with Capcom on these titles. And obviously, you know, we're big fans of fighting games here, so this is really exciting news, and definitely something you'll be hearing a lot more about in the next year.
And you know, as much as we would hope it's a new Darkstalkers game, you have to remember that Dimps has done all of the Dragon Ball Z Budokai and the upcoming Xenoverse, so it would be interesting to see. I mean, obviously it's not going to be another Dragon Ball game, but, you know, something along that style with a new IP maybe, so.
Well, and something that's interesting about that is that that really shows how versatile Dimps is as a developer, because they also did the Street Fighter IV series. And those are as straight-laced as fighting games get, really.
Yep.
So, you know, they can do both the over-the-top style and a straightforward fighting game. Really great developers, very underrated, even though I know a lot of people didn't like their take on the Sonic games.
Yeah.
But either way, for fighting games, I think they actually do pretty well, especially with Capcom sort of reining them in. Anyway, definitely. You'll hear a lot more about that over the next year.
Please look forward to it.
We also have word here that Square Enix is preparing Vita ports of two of their more popular mobile phone games. One of them is Dead Man's Cross, which actually has a US release already on iOS, so if you're interested, you can play that. It is a zombie first-person shooter with card battles. The more exciting one to me, of course, and this is a game we haven't talked about much here on the show recently, which is why we decided this was news and not a follow-up, is Rise of Mana.
Hey!
Now, Rise of Mana, unfortunately, is a free-to-play game with microtransactions, which, you know, strictly speaking, we are open to here on GameBuie. But, unfortunately, talking to people online about Rise of Mana does show that the game, unfortunately, is very, it's not designed to let a free-to-play player win. So it's definitely focused on, like, the pay-to-win philosophy. So that sucks. Hopefully, if the Vita version is a paid product, they will fix the design of the game somehow. Either way, both of these games are being retooled to work with controllers rather than touchscreen interfaces. So let's hope for the best.
Yeah. We heard an interesting little bombshell when Samsung and Oculus announced that they are going to be releasing the Samsung Gear VR, which actually involves the Samsung Galaxy Note 4 by actually slotting the Note 4 in as a screen. And it's like a little brother to the Oculus Rift, but, you know, obviously not quite as powerful. And it's still an early access beta version. They're calling it the Innovator Edition, you know, that they want for content creators and, you know, enthusiasts. We do know that there will be some things including Darknet, which is a game that was talked about at PAX Prime, Oculus Cinema, a virtual movie theater, and most exciting for me, Legendary's Pacific Rim Jaeger Pilot, which is a VR experience that was discussed at Comic-Con.
Yeah, and you know, something else that was announced for Gear VR was Harmonix Music VR.
Ooh!
This is software that Harmonix is developing for the Gear VR headset that it's going to be like a VR music visualizer. So it's going to be a little bit, you know, it's not really going to be like a game, but it is specifically going to be, you know, like, using VR and your own music to sort of provide you with, like, procedurally generated audio visualizations in a VR environment.
Yeah.
So that's really exciting to me. One of the appeals of the Galaxy Note 4 display in the Gear VR is that it is a cordless iteration of VR. You know, I have an Oculus version 1 dev kit, and one problem I do have with it is that anytime you're playing a game where you have to look around you in like a 360 motion, the cords start to get tangled up, so the idea of one of these things that is cordless is actually really appealing, and I want to bring that back to talking about Harmonix Music VR, because, you know, I think it would be really fun to, you know, sort of explore these visualizations without a cord. If you want to lay down while you listen to music and explore this visual world, you could do that. I feel like this would be just a really cool thing to experiment with and have fun.
Yeah, and you know, I've never been quite the phablet person, but this kind of makes me want a Note 4.
Ah! In other news, we have word that The Room 3 is going to be hitting iOS and Android in spring 2015. This is the third game in the phenomenally well-loved puzzle game series. This is sort of designed in the same vein as, like, The Seventh Guest or The Eleventh Hour, you know, like, sort of like an FMV sort of exploring a mansion with puzzles.
Interesting.
Just some really weird stuff.
And so, no relation to the Tommy Wiseau film.
Yep, absolutely no relation.
Oh, here's some news that's really exciting. Kitty White, the little girl from London, will be coming with her pals to the Nintendo 3DS with Hello Kitty and Sanrio Friends 3D Racing.
Oh, exciting.
The ESRB rating summary, it says, this is a racing game in which players drive Hello Kitty and her friends in carts, boats, and planes around whimsical race courses. Some races contain power-up items, e.g. speed bursts, traffic cones, pies, that are tossed at other racers, causing them to briefly spin out of control. And Gamefly has a listing for November 11th with Majesco listed as a publisher. So, we'll have to see. Some people think maybe this is an updated version of a Hello Kitty Cruisers, the Wii U game from last year.
That's exciting. You know, I never got around to playing Hello Kitty Cruisers. You know, we should do that. We should have a Hello Kitty Cruisers cart party.
We should. If you dress up as Kitty White, you'll get a, you can win a contest, maybe.
You just really want to talk about the whole Hello Kitty identity thing.
Yep.
LOL. We have word here that Frozen Synapse, this is the incredible turn-based strategy game that was released back on Steam like a year or two ago, is coming to the Vita. This will be releasing on September 23rd as Frozen Synapse Prime, and of course, the port is being handled by developer Mode 7 themselves.
Fantastic.
In conjunction with Little Big Planet Vita developer Double 11. So that's really
lots of numbers.
Oh my gosh, there is, but that's really exciting.
They could be called Double Mode 7-11.
Oh my gosh, girl, well done. We also have word here that Attack on Titan is getting another 3DS game. This one is going to be called Attack on Titan: The Last Wings of Humanity Chain.
Wow.
The last game was Attack on Titan: The Last Wings of Humanity, so all bets are that the chain version of the game is more of an enhanced release rather than a sequel or new game. It's apparently going to feature several new stages, new missions, and various other additions, including 20 new voices for characters already from the old game, as well as for new characters that will be in the game, and online play, including both up to 4-player online multiplayer, as well as leaderboards of some kind.
Wonderful. Do you have something else to say?
Well, you know, this is also going to be available as an update for the original release, available for 2,160 yen if you have the original.
Oh, wonderful. Sorry to cut you off. Mind Zero, which is the dungeon crawler for Vita from Acquire, is coming to Steam via the Greenlight program. So Axis is trying to get the game greenlit. It'll support dual audio. And if you want to see Mind Zero on your PC and you don't have a Vita, or if you just want to support a dungeon crawler from Acquire, go greenlight it.
And, you know, Mind Zero is an interesting game because it's very derivative of the Persona series. But, you know, while being derivative of something in the game's space is often considered a negative, at the same time, you know, Persona. So the game plays very much like an off-brand Persona. It follows a lot of very similar themes and even has very similar gameplay mechanics.
Ooh.
So it's actually, you know, as these kinds of games go, it's actually a pretty cool experience. Most of the negative attention it saw was just from the fact that, oh, it's like an off-brand Persona. But in my estimation, that's really not too bad a thing to be.
Yeah.
We also have word here, finally, a little bit of detail on Game 4 coming out of The Behemoth. Game 4 is going to be a turn-based strategy game for PC and Xbox One. They're specifically creating it to be sort of like a quirky and amusing game, since apparently they feel that there isn't a lot of personality in that space. So they very specifically want to create a game that sort of plays on what the expected tropes are without actually playing into them. So, please look forward to that. I certainly am. Of course, unfortunately, knowing how the Behemoth's design philosophy typically goes, I kind of expect that it's going to be a while before we get to play this game.
Yeah. Not content to let Meat Boy have the Endless Runner spotlight, Sackboy is now going to have his own Endless Runner with Run Sackboy Run, which is coming to Vita, iOS, and Android sometime in October.
And this game will have bonus awards that will be unlocked in Little Big Planet 3 if you play in Run Sackboy Run.
Yeah, and this is free to play, so why not?
Yeah, pretty much.
It looks really cute if the screenshots, you know, are any detail.
We also have word on a new project coming out of WayForward. You know, we here at GameBuoy are big fans of WayForward, and their next big title is going to be a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle game called Danger of the Ooze.
What?
The most exciting part here is that this Xbox 360, PS3, and 3DS game is going to be a non-linear side-scrolling adventure action game. Obviously, that's sort of the general way that you would describe what we call a Metroidvania.
A mutant turtlevania?
Alright. So, you know, it is apparently going to have like a twin castle style mechanic, what we think of from the Castlevania series, where you explore both New York as well as Dimension X and teleport, you know, between the two throughout the game. Obviously, you know, this is really exciting. I love Metroidvania-style games. I like the Ninja Turtles as a brand, even if I haven't watched any of the movies or shows in many years. So I'm actually really stoked for this. I think this could be something really special.
Yeah. In some heartwarming but also bittersweet news, a Robin Williams tribute has been confirmed in the Warlords of Draenor beta for World of Warcraft. He appears as the NPC Robin, who is a genie that is summoned out of a burning, ever-burning lamp that says, infinite cosmic power, and then says, itty-bitty living space. For those who weren't familiar, the late, great Robin Williams was a huge fan of games and anime and all the sorts of things that we're fans of here on the Buoy.
He was also a WoW player himself.
He was a WoW player who, legend has it, would troll trade chat on slow days.
And, you know, data miners have actually found other potential Robin Williams-inspired items as well, including a large broken egg that could very easily be the egg that Mork from Ork came from.
And did you see the Datamine character model that looks like Mrs. Doubtfire?
Yes, I have. They also found a new title in the game that is going to be Comedian.
Aw.
So, you know, we are certainly, it has been confirmed and seen that, you know, Robin the Genie is a real thing. And for all we know, this might just be the first step of many in terms of a Robin Williams tribute in World of Warcraft.
Oh, bless Blizzard.
In other Blizzard news, we also got word out of them that we will be seeing a full expansion for their hit card game, Hearthstone, quote-unquote, soon.
Oh, that famous Blizzard stone.
And we'll be getting iPhone and Android versions of Hearthstone by the end of the year. So, you know, that's really exciting. And, you know, if I were a betting man, I would say that we will probably get a full information blowout on the Hearthstone expansion at BlizzCon in a month and a half.
I just hope you don't mean a blowout in the Koopa Club sense.
I would never. And last, but certainly not least, we have word that the upcoming Xperia Z3 compact tablet line will feature remote play for the PlayStation 4.
Huh.
Yeah, so that's really exciting. You know, we see a lot of people starting to ape that Wii U second screen functionality. Obviously, you know, the Vita can already do remote play. I haven't messed with it too much, but my understanding is that it's actually a really cool feature. I know that Destiny is specifically going to have an alternate control setting for Vita remote players that will, like, map certain actions to the touch screen so that even though the Vita has fewer buttons, you won't be lost for any of actions or abilities. You'll still be able to play the game fully just on your Vita.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so that's really cool. And, you know, it's cool that Sony's opening this up with their phone line. I think that a lot of people probably enjoy that since, you know, who has a Vita?
I do.
Well, I mean, me too. Anyway, that's about it for our news today. Unfortunately, though, we do have some...
Doom and Gloom.
Yeah, unfortunately, ZeniMax Online, which is, of course, a division of ZeniMax, who are the owners of Bethesda... have had to have some reductions in workforce. This is all focused on the launch and development of The Elder Scrolls Online, and it's been 6 months post-launch. I keep forgetting that that game's out. And unfortunately, to meet the ongoing needs of the studio, they had to adjust staffing. So, you know, we hope these people land on their feet, and...
You know, we certainly do hope these people land on their feet and get new employment quickly. But I have to say, that explanation rings hollow for me. ZeniMax really tried to package this as like, oh, this is a normal part in the ebb and flow of the design process and release process. But if you remember, like, there are supposed to be PS3 and 4 and Xbox 360 and 1 console versions of this game coming. So, like, your release process isn't done. You should still have people working on these ports.
Yeah,
so this to me speaks of something a little more sinister in terms of, you know, we keep hearing about the low subscriber numbers to the Elder Scrolls Online.
A lot of people think it's going to be free to play within the next 6 months.
You know what? My thing is, everyone says that about every MMO. People
Except
were saying
WoW.
That. People still say that about WoW. Like, oh, I'll come back when it's free to play. Hi, Rob. And, you know, a lot of people say that about Final Fantasy XIV, or at least were before they broke the 1 million subscribers mark.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't put too much stock into the fact that, like, oh, a lot of people think it'll be free to play by the end of the year. I put a lot of stock into the fact that they are laying off the team before it's even hit all of their target platforms. That, to me,
yeah,
is a huge red flag, and I am worried about that game. And, you know, something that's really, really cool about The Elder Scrolls Online is that it has playable races in the game that you can't even unlock until you've played the game.
That's interesting.
Like, you can start as a human and then become a werewolf or a vampire.
Oh, that's right.
By encountering those characters in-game and being, you know, bit or cursed. And it fundamentally changes your character permanently to have different skills and attributes and abilities. I can't think of another MMO that's ever done anything like that. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I bet if it goes free to play at some point, Seawolf Jason will jump right on that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, heck, just that mechanic, because, you know, I love vampires. Just that mechanic really makes me want to buy the game and roll a character just to try and, like, find a vampire and become one. In any event, we have nothing but sympathy for the people who have unfortunately lost their jobs. We hope everyone lands on their feet, and we hope you find more employment within the gaming space as soon as possible.
Indeed.
All right, well, that's sort of the end of our news and our follow-ups.
Yeah, and, you know, speaking of something that probably ultimately ended in a lot of jobs lost in the industry.
Yeah, so it's time to talk about the Dreamcast. And, you know, we're going to sort of structure this discussion. We're going to talk about sort of different aspects of the Dreamcast. And the first thing I really want to look at is sort of less specifically about the Dreamcast and more about Sega in general.
Yeah, that's an interesting saga.
Well, you know, you really have to consider where Sega was at when the time of the Dreamcast sort of came. You know, the Sega CD and the 32X were both huge failures, really.
Yep.
The Saturn, while not strictly speaking a huge failure, was still like the last place console of that generation.
Yeah, I mean, really what hurt it was the surprise launch of the Saturn.
Yeah, that did a lot of damage to the Saturn not ever really getting a foothold in.
Right.
It was almost like the opposite of what Sega wanted to happen. Like, they wanted it to be like this big event and a surprise, and they wanted everyone to run out and get a Saturn right now. But instead, no stores were prepared, and everyone started to hear that it was a crap show, and ultimately it really, really damaged the Saturn.
Yeah, I mean, the Saturn was not a bad system, it's just the timing was way off, and it was a victim of circumstances.
Yeah, yeah. So in the end, you know, people at the time looked at the 32-bit generation as like PlayStation or Nintendo 64. Like, Saturn didn't even enter people's consciousness.
Yeah.
In my school, in fact, you know, when the Saturn came out, like, I was one of two people I knew that had a Saturn.
Mm.
And, you know, I talk a lot historically about games from the perspective of, you know, my own experiences. And, you know, I knew all the other nerds in school, and even among the nerds, like, nobody was pro-Saturn.
Oh, yeah, that's a bummer.
And, you know, the crazy thing is, and I know this is about an episode about the Dreamcast, not the Saturn, so I'm not going to stick on this point too long, but I think we all agree at this point that the Saturn was, like, deeply underappreciated.
Yeah, it was kind of ahead of its time.
It was absolutely ahead of its time. You know, it had a lot of, like, for the first time ever, like, real, true, arcade-perfect adaptations and ports. Where, like, you would buy a game and literally get as close to the arcade as possible. You know, it's like, some of the timing windows on some of the Capcom fighting games would be a little weaker, but not anything like previous generations had seen.
Mm.
So, anyway, Saturn, underappreciated, definitely dragged Sega's name in the mud. Sega needed a hit. They needed one really bad. Their stocks were literally at all-time low. And, you know, things were so bad that, actually, Sega specifically didn't include the name Sega in the Dreamcast's name.
Oh, yeah, it was just Dreamcast.
Yeah, absolutely. They very specifically wanted to mask Sega's name from all of the pre-launch publicity for the console. And, you know, that's sort of why in previous generations, you know, Sega branding was real prominent on their packaging and, you know, on their devices. And the Dreamcast instead just had, like, that orange, or blue if you're in the EU territories, swirl as its logo, and not, like, it was not, like, super heavily Sega branded.
You know, the blue version of the swirl is an emoji.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's super cute.
I don't know if it's a coincidence, but it looks a lot like the Dreamcast swirl.
And the funny thing is, you know, according to the designers that designed the swirl, it's supposed to symbolize the universe and the infinite power of human beings.
Aww.
You know, so we have Sega sort of in, like, the late 90s, like 97 specifically. They're struggling pretty much everywhere, but particularly in North America, which in the generation prior with the Sega Genesis, North America was, like, their stronghold. Like, Sega literally would not have really gotten through that generation without North America.
Mm-hmm.
So the president of Sega of America, Bernie Stolar, he was specifically, like, telling the Japanese headquarters, like, we need a new platform. We need it not to be, like, super Sega branded. We need to distance it from what Sega is right now, but we need it because with the numbers we're doing right now, this is not a sustainable business. And that sort of brings us, you know, to sort of the next angle I wanted to talk about the Dreamcast, which is really more of, like, the tech angle. And Sega did something really weird here, and they had their previous engineers, the ones that had done their previous hardware, design a Power VR hardware to power their next console, and, you know, sort of keep things in-house sort of the way that they had done previously. But they also had a team go over and work with 3DFX. And they were also developing a potential Dreamcast. You know, one of the hardware projects was called the Katana, and the other was called the Dural. And Dural was named after the last boss of the Virtua Fighter series.
Oh.
And, you know, the idea here was that they were going to have one do a traditional design. You know, their in-house guys do, like, a traditional design. And 3DFX team that was working, you know, the team working with 3DFX was supposed to be, like, sort of quote-unquote out-of-the-box thinkers, sort of creating more of a radical console design that would really bring new ideas to their hardware platform. You know, unfortunately, and fortunately, because I certainly do love what the Dreamcast became, but they ended up going with the in-house design. And, you know, ultimately, Sega went with the Katana design, and that's the one that they were doing in-house with the Power VR processors. And, you know, the 3DFX Voodoo 2-based processor board, the Dural, supposedly was actually the more powerful of the two designs. Hmm. But unfortunately, you know, working with an overseas company, 3DFX, who was based, you know, not in Japan, there were a lot of leaks. We got a lot of information about what the Dreamcast was going to be very early on, and a lot of people think that's why Sega ultimately didn't go with 3DFX. And this is a big enough deal that the 3DFX people actually sued Sega, because they felt like Sega going with their internal design rather than 3DFX was not based on any legitimate business reason.
Oh.
And, you know, certainly settling out of court doesn't imply anything. I can tell you that as someone who works in law. But it is interesting that Sega did not let that case go to court. They did settle out of court. So, either way, you know, the console that we ended up getting was the one designed with the VR, Power VR tech, designed primarily internally at Sega. And interestingly, you know, the console, a lot of people think that it had, like, the first, like, onboard, like, operating system. You know, you would power it on and you'd have, you know, all of your suite of options stuff. But that's actually not strictly true. It did have a very, like, rudimentary operating system on board, but actually every game had its own complete version of that operating system on the disc, not entirely dissimilar to how Nintendo handled that with the original Wii.
Oh, okay.
The original Wii, you know, when you press your home button and you get a little menu for, like, go to the Wii menu and everything. That's actually fate. Like, there is not an operating system running in the background the entire time you're running programs. That's actually a specific set of calls and protocol that Nintendo made every software designer include in every game. To create, like, this uniform shell that created the illusion of an operating system that was persistent.
Wow.
And Sega actually did the same thing with the Dreamcast. And there's actually a really popular belief about the Dreamcast I want to dispel right now. Microsoft worked for years with Sega on the Dreamcast. That is fact. They had created, using DirectX, an optimized version of Windows CE that powered several of the titles. That is also correct. But the Dreamcast itself and the Dreamcast's OS as we think about it was not running Windows CE in any context or capacity. But again, through their work with Microsoft, they did create a sort of environment that ran on the Dreamcast's hardware natively that allowed them to use Windows CE and DirectX calls in Dreamcast games. Which, you know, is actually super interesting, because Microsoft themselves really pushed Sega, to put Windows CE on the Dreamcast as its primary operating system in a persistent always-on opacity. So, you know, it's really interesting because a lot of people look at the time and even now at the Xbox as being almost like a follow-up to the Dreamcast. And, you know, there's actually a lot of support for that for those ideas. There really are, you know, a lot of similar tech aspects between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, funny enough, Sega actually made sequels to a lot of their software on the Xbox.
That's true.
But this is not an episode on the Xbox, so I don't want to go too far down that road. I just wanted, you know, from a development standpoint, it's really interesting to look at Microsoft's involvement. And, you know, again, Microsoft clearly wanted an in the console space that they thought the Dreamcast would provide them.
Yeah.
And, you know, something I want to talk about now is the actual launch of the Dreamcast. And, you know, a lot of people look at the Dreamcast now and they only remember its early demise. Unfortunately, you know, Sega discontinued the Dreamcast and stopped production in the first quarter of 2001. So in North America, the Dreamcast was only properly alive for like a year and a quarter.
That's so crazy.
But on launch day, a record 300,000 units had been pre-ordered, and in less than 2 weeks, the Dreamcast had moved more than 500,000 units.
That's pretty good for the time.
Well, and another thing is that, you know, that was actually their entire shipment allocation for launch. Launches used to be smaller than they are these days, as you remark, but Sega was actually unable to fulfill all of the pre-orders and meet launch demand. This console actually had, like, again, much like the PS2 after it, the Nintendo Wii, the PS3, Dreamcasts were in demand and people were hunting stores to try and find them because they were sold out everywhere. That's something a lot of people don't really think about. To the point that non-games press, you know, actually, like, renowned magazines and publications such as Business Week were referring to the Sega Dreamcast as, like, the hot thing to have in 1999. You know, and, something else I really want to talk about the launch was that, to me, this was the first console that really had, like, a killer software lineup from launch day.
It really did.
And Slaggy, I know you did a little bit of research as to, like, what the launch lineup was for the Dreamcast when it launched. Why don't you talk about those titles?
Yeah, so this might not be as impressive by today's standards, but it launched with 18 games, if I'm counting right.
Wow! So there, you have to keep in mind, you know, this was during an era where you had console launches
with, like, two games.
With, like, two games, exactly what I was gonna say.
So there was Aero Wings, Air Force Delta, Blue Stinger.
Blue Stinger was actually really cool, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, because I do want you to list all these games, but, you know, it's worth mentioning, Blue Stinger was a really cool, like, sci-fi Resident Evil type game, very, like, Japanese designed, very off the wall. A lot of people considered it, like, almost like a Japanese sci-fi, like, Twin Peaks style experience.
Huh.
That game still has a lot of followers, definitely a cult fan base for that one. I'm sorry, continue.
Cart, Flag to Flag, Expendable, The House of the Dead 2.
Which, I mean, what needs to be said about that except suffer the same way G did?
Hydro Thunder, Monaco Grand Prix, Mortal Kombat Gold.
Yes!
NFL Blitz 2000, Pen Pen, Trill Salam.
Yes!
Power Stone.
Which, you know, we're going to talk about Power Stone a little bit when we do the software showcase. But it has to be said, you know, Capcom was a huge supporter of the Dreamcast. And on launch day, they had ready a game that, you know, we talk about it here all the time on GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
Anytime you bring up the Dreamcast among a group of hardcore gamers, Power Stone is going to come up. And the thing to think about is that that was a launch day game out of Capcom's stable. Like, they didn't need focus groups. They didn't need to see the, like, what kind of audiences were playing Dreamcast. Like, bam, right out of the gate, they had this amazing new take on, like, the fighting genre that to this day resonates with gamers.
Yep, and I bet Wicked over at, the Nerdgasm Network and the Game Over Takeover podcast just squealed. He loves Power Stone.
It's so good.
And for good reason. There was Ready to Rumble Boxing, Sonic Adventure, Soul Calibur, TNN Motorsports Hardcore Heat.
And you know, I have to say real quick, Soul Calibur is notable because that game actually ran better on the Dreamcast than the arcade version ran. And there's actually, like, there's, like, a whole talking point about Dreamcast as it relates to arcade performance. We're going to get to it in a little bit. We've actually talked about it here on the show hundreds of times. But anyway, I digress. Continue.
Tokyo Extreme Racer and Trick Style. And on top of that, there were, like, another 30 games alone before the end of 1999 in North America.
Yeah, I mean, really.
It's a massive library for the holiday season.
And, you know, something funny is I'm sitting here racking my brain, like, I'm trying to think of another console that had such an amazing launch window period for software
basically
support.
Like 50 games, no big deal.
Right?
In the first 3 months.
And, like, the only console I'm finding is, like, maybe the Wii U? Because, you know, the Wii U, as we talked here on the show, launched with 25 games.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny, because, you know, that's another console that I think I can safely say at this point is underappreciated in its time. So, anyway, I feel like there are a lot of parallels there. In any event, just phenomenal software support from all corners of games. You know, this thing had incredible Western support. It had incredible Japanese support. You know, EA wanted to sign an exclusive deal with Sega so that no other developers could release sports games on their console. And Sega said no, so EA refused to support the Dreamcast. So Sega worked with, I think it was 2K. They worked with one of the other studios, and they started a line of sports titles. Sega Sports.
That they even had the Sega Sports Special Edition Dreamcast.
Yeah, I actually had one of those because it was black. Oh. I sanded off the Sega Sports iconography, though. So it's just a black Dreamcast. In any event, you know, it's really notable because the Sega Sports games, their football game, was the first time that Madden wasn't the top-selling football game since its inception. So really, it's super notable, you know, the Sega Dreamcast had such incredible software support coming out of the gate.
Yeah, and I mean, even within the first month, there was a King of Fighters, Marvel vs. Capcom. About a month later, there was Time Stalkers was launched on the same day as Marvel vs. Capcom. There was Virtua Fighter 3 TB, Team Metal. There's like a JoJo's Bizarre Adventure game from Capcom within the first month or so. And, you know, like more, like NBA 2K. Yeah, so that was part of the Sega Sports line. And, I mean, we're just talking about within the first 3 months of launch.
And, you know, something that you can really take from the titles that Slaggy just listed, this thing was a beast for those of you that had software tastes similar to me. You know, it had a wealth of JRPGs, including the well-loved Skies of Arcadia. This thing, it had fighting games up the wazoo, both the best of the best of Capcom and the best of the best of the SNK fighters were all coming to the Dreamcast in arcade perfect or even better than arcade form. Which, you know, obviously that had never really happened before. In previous generations, you didn't really see arcade perfect games at all, much less better than arcade. And, you know, if you were getting support from, you know, the SNKs, you weren't getting the Capcoms, or vice versa. So to really see all of this come together on the same platform and performing so well, for those of you with tastes like those that we have here on GameBuoy.org, this console, the Dreamcast, man, it was a revelation, which I really think plays into why it's so well-loved even now. And, you know, unfortunately, it's time to talk a little bit about the lifespan of the thing. Unfortunately, you know, the Sega Dreamcast, it was announced on January 31st, 2001, that they were no longer going to be producing Dreamcasts after March 30th of that year. Luckily, the last North American retail software release was NHL 2K2, which released in February 2002, so we did get a whole nother year of software support. My understanding is that the European and Japanese markets supported the console for another 6 months or so after that. So the last wave of European and Japanese games we didn't actually get here. We did get a lot of those titles ported to other platforms, including, you know, the PS2 and the Xbox. And also, you know, the GameCube to some degree. And we're gonna call out a lot of those titles specifically when we do the software spotlight. But it's really incredible just to think we're ultimately at most talking about a 2.5 year window.
Yeah, and I mean, before it started coming downhill, it was outselling the N64.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And if Sega could have continued supporting it, I think it would have outperformed the Nintendo GameCube.
Oh, probably, yeah.
Then I'd say that it would have outperformed the Xbox, but first off, that's like, of course. And second off, the Xbox might not have existed.
True.
Which, you know, we don't get too much into supposition here on Game Buoy. But it is worth mentioning, you know, the Dreamcast was just incredibly important to a certain kind of gamer. And to a lot of games historians, it's sort of viewed as like a watershed. Because the Dreamcast was a console that was designed very specifically to appeal to the hardcore. This was a console that was designed to sell to the enthusiast. It was designed and supported. Basically, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably the exact kind of person that the Dreamcast was targeted for.
Right. And, you know, I think something that was interesting for me is that at the time, the Dreamcast seemed like a rebirth, like, especially with how well it did at launch over here in North America, the huge launch library, it really seemed like, wow, you know, Sega is finally turning it around.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there's even still the fact that people get as passionate as we do really shows you that the Dreamcast was successful with that market. Unfortunately, it was not really positioned as like a sells to the whole family multimedia device or whatever.
Yep, didn't play DVDs.
Did not play DVDs. It actually, and we're going to talk about this a little bit in a minute, but it used a proprietary disc format called GD-ROM. GD stands for, like, Giga Disc, and basically each disc had just over 1 gig of space on it for software. So, you know, you had a bump up from the, at the time, predominant CD format. And, you know, that's actually, you know, something that's pretty interesting. We're going to talk about it in, you know, a few minutes. But it did not support, you know, DVDs, which was the video format that was becoming a big deal, which Sony did capitalize on for the PlayStation 2, quite famously.
Yep, that was my first DVD player.
Yeah, I think that's true for a lot of people. And so, you know, again, a lot of games historians look at the Dreamcast as why companies to this day don't market consoles just to the video game enthusiasts.
Yeah.
Why these things are positioned as like an all-in-one set-top box that the whole family will want. Because unfortunately, and you know, it's time to move on to sort of our discussion on what killed the Dreamcast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unfortunately, support for the Dreamcast got weak in a hurry.
Well, it did not have a good Japanese launch, did it?
The Japanese launch was really strange. They had a really hard time getting all of the necessary chips and processors from NEC in order to get as many units out the door as they wanted. It had a fairly weak software lineup, although it did launch with Sonic Adventure and Godzilla Generations, which was a weak game, but a lot of fun to watch because it was very pretty for its era. My first Dreamcast experience was an anime convention that just happened to be happening a week after the Japanese Dreamcast launch. So one of the import booths that I always went to at these anime conventions had just a row of TVs playing a couple of different Dreamcast games. And watching the Sonic Adventure opening in 1999, or I'm sorry, actually this was in 1998 because it launched in Japan a little earlier, it was like groundbreaking and crazy to see these graphics and running in real time that like, this looks better than PS1, like pre-rendered CGI.
Yeah.
Like Sonic is running around this city that looks better than any FMV in the PlayStation 1 Final Fantasies to that point. So it was really, really eye-opening and really incredible. Unfortunately, again, support from the user base dried out almost overnight. It was really crazy. Just Sega went from moving huge numbers of hardware and, you know, software sales being really brisk and very good to almost overnight, like, suddenly people weren't able to turn a profit on this thing. And there are two predominant theories on why that is. The first, of course, is that Sony, while hyping the PlayStation 2, made a lot of claims that never substantiated. And, you know, by what I mean when I say that, the long and short of it is that Sony overhyped the PlayStation 2 using, like, lies and false information.
And, I mean, we do have to recognize that the PS2 was backwards compatible. That was a pretty big deal at the time. It did have a DVD player, and, you know, so, I mean, it wasn't purely...
Slidekick, the issue here isn't that the PlayStation 2 was or was not desirable. The issue is that Sony made claims such as the PlayStation 2 would have controllers that would allow it to interface directly with your brain, which is a real thing they claimed. To more nefarious claims, like that the PlayStation 2 would be able to render Toy Story in real time, and that it would be able to render, like, the Final Fantasy 8 ballroom scene in real time, to the point that Sony actually at conferences faked, like, these elaborate presentations using Story and Final Fantasy CGI using alternate camera angles. And having someone with an unplugged controller on stage supposedly controlling the camera angle to prove that it was in real time. So that by direct comparison, it made the Dreamcast look embarrassingly weak. And you know how those game enthusiasts are about weak consoles. Like, they don't want nothing to do with that. So, you know, there was a really effective smear campaign run by Sony against the Dreamcast in favor of the PlayStation 2. Now, don't get me wrong. PlayStation 2, there was no way that thing wasn't going to be a hit. Like you mentioned, Slaggy, it had the backward compatibility running for it. It had the DVD support working for it. But those things shouldn't have affected the Dreamcast the way they did. This super elaborate hoax by Sony, especially the graphics hoax, which, I mean, literally, the visuals that Sony was claiming were running in real time on PlayStation 2, like, PlayStation 3 games didn't look that good.
Yeah.
Like, it's really, they really positioned, using this false information, the PlayStation 2 as, like, why would you even think about a Dreamcast if you could have a PlayStation 2? And unfortunately, that ad campaign was very successful. And, you know, for those of you who think I'm making this stuff up or pulling it out of my ass, I appreciate why you might think that, but you can still go on YouTube and pull up, like, Sony's, like, claims that the PlayStation 2 is going to run these things in real time. Like, I am not making it up, and it was a huge coup at the time in convincing gamers that the Dreamcast was literally not worth owning.
Yeah, I was reading a thread about where this kind of originated, and they did. They said, oh, it would have movie-quality 3D. Apparently, the N64 also claimed it could have graphics as good as Jurassic Park.
Well, the thing about that is that that's sort of a misappropriated idea. The graphics processors in the Nintendo 64 were from Silicon Graphics, and they used similar, like the same type of processor as the rendering workstations that created Jurassic Park.
And then apparently Bill Gates said that the Xbox could have Toy Story 2 graphics.
Yeah, and that to me, I always took that as, and I don't mean to excuse Nintendo and Microsoft, but that to me always seemed like Microsoft taking on Sony's Toy Story claim head on. Like, if the PlayStation 2 can do Toy Story 1, our console could do Toy Story 2. And to be fair to that claim, the original Xbox is much more powerful than the PlayStation 2.
But so is the GameCube, right?
The GameCube is also more powerful than the PlayStation 2. Which is funny, because that's much like the Wii generation, that's another instance where the weakest console won the generation.
Yep.
And, you know, obviously a lot of people in conversations like that, especially Sony fanboys, want to point out, like, oh, look at the rain effects on Metal Gear Solid 2. There's no way the PlayStation 2 was weaker. But the real fact of the matter is any console where you code to the metal and really wring the most performance out of your console, you're going to get efforts that sing. And that's true for the PlayStation 2, it's true for the Wii, it's true for 3DS, it is true for literally every gaming console that has ever existed.
Yeah.
But this is a Dreamcast episode, not an anti-Sony episode.
Yeah.
Though it is very easy for the two to cross. A lot of us Dreamcast enthusiasts still have issues with the way Sony did Sega dirty that.
Well, I think for a lot of us, Sony has only started to kind of come around with the later part of the PS3's lifespan.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you remember the early days of Game Boy where I was like, Sony.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But, you know, there is, unfortunately, an even bigger problem that Dreamcast faced. And that was that the Dreamcast openly supported running software on the GD-ROM format. It also read software that was just on CDs. And the problem is, this became really easily exploited for people to pirate games really easily. This was the same window of time, right there at the end of the 90s, the beginning of the 2000s, where everybody had a CD burner for the first time. People were buying their Hewlett-Packard desktops, their compacts that would come with CD burners. Some people like myself, an audiophile, I had a CD burner in the mid-90s. So, you know, by the time the Dreamcast came out, almost, I would say within a few months, we started to see games pop up online where you just had to download the ISO, burn it to a CD, to a CDR, and you could pop it into your console with little to no modification and be playing pirated games immediately. So, you know, and that really caused a huge hit. And this is something that games historians still talk about. You know, a lot of people talk about Dreamcast games, and even here in studio, you know, you're listening to us talk about, you know, 40, 50 Dreamcast games. Now, I was not a Dreamcast pirate. I actually got my first job.
You're a podcast pirate.
Right? I got my first job during the Dreamcast era, my first adult paying job. And my parents, whom I were still living with at the time, were really cool. And for my first paycheck, they just dropped me off at the mall, and they were like, buy whatever you want, spend as much of your money as you want, you don't owe us any rent this month. So I went and bought literally 25 Dreamcast games with my first paycheck.
Hey.
I had a huge bag from the EB Games that just had 25 Dreamcast games in it. And I still have all these games. I took all kinds of chances on software I'd never heard of. Not really the point. Most people from the Dreamcast era who talk about these huge number of games, unfortunately, have played all of these games because piracy was so easy and so insidious that, like, I would go to school and people would just be openly handing out Dreamcast CDR. Like, everyone who had a Dreamcast were just openly giving each other CDs. Like, oh, have you played Mars Matrix yet? Here's a CD of it. And, you know, in an environment like that, where even in, like, public schools in the East Bay of California, people are just freely trading Dreamcast pirate games like they were Pokemon cards, that is a really toxic environment for turning a profit on software development. So, you know, ultimately, that's what is generally considered by games historians to have brought the Dreamcast down, was, you know, the Sony smear campaign and the rampant piracy.
Which is ironic that Sega, who thrived by doing smear campaigns of their own, fell victim to one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Genesis does what Nintendo don't.
Oh, I misheard you. I thought you said justice does what Nintendo don't.
Ah.
I thought you were saying it was karmic justice that this happened to Sega. Anyway, so I want to talk a little bit right now about a software spotlight on the Dreamcast. You know, we talked a little bit about how it got made, about how it was received, about what ultimately killed it. But what I want to talk about in this segment right now is why we loved this thing. And you know, like any gaming platform, it's gonna live or die based on what kind of software support it sees. And the Sega Dreamcast, you know, as we've said probably too many times at this point, had one of the most amazing lineups of gaming software that I've ever seen for any console. Frankly, even to this date, I don't feel like any console has as many hits as the Dreamcast had.
Yeah, I mean, as we go through this list, you'll be like, oh, they've mentioned that on Game Buoy a dozen times.
And so here's a little list of like 11 titles that I just put together off the top of my head. This is not even a super researched list.
Yeah, I'm like, I already see a couple that you didn't include.
Well, good, because once I list these, like, 11, I want you to talk about these. We're gonna cover a few more in our feedback this week. So, you know, this thing launched with Sonic Adventure, which, you know, to a lot of people, is still, like, the only 3D Sonic game worth playing.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us look at Sonic Adventure as the beginning of the end, because Sonic Adventure 2 wasn't as good, in my opinion, and then you ended up with things like Shadow the Hedgehog, you ended up with things like Sonic 2006, and really,
yeah,
really we're only starting to see Sonic kind of have a return to form.
And even then, you know, the Sonic Return to Form that we talk about
is on Nintendo.
Is on, well, yeah, it is on Nintendo.
It's thanks to Nintendo, basically.
But, you know, the step back to that is really Sonic Generations, let's be fair. Sonic
yeah.
Generations, for a lot of people, was like the Return of the King. And now we're all hoping that Sega can keep that up.
Well, yeah, it'll remain to be seen how Sonic Boom turns out.
Sonic Boom, Sonic Boom,
Sonic Boom.
So, you know, obviously Sonic Adventure, but another game that's well-loved, still super highly regarded, is Jet Set Radio.
Yeah, Jet Grind Radio.
Jet Grind Radio, yes. You know, this game was known at the time for its distinctive graphics. It had, you know, a very cool art design, which, you know, I'm separating from graphics because the two, strictly speaking, feed into each other but aren't the same thing. It had this really cool, like, graffiti aesthetic. That was really sold by the game's use of the cel-shaded graphics tech. It had, like, rhythmic, like, puzzle elements in terms of how to perform the graffiti and doing the controller motions. It had a really cool, well-designed interpretation of, like, Japan. And an amazing soundtrack. You know, that's something that game doesn't get nearly enough love for, was its really cool soundtrack. So, Jet Set Radio, you know, it still gets ports all the time.
Yeah, there was an Xbox port, which was one of the earliest ones.
There was, of course, the Xbox, original Xbox actually got a sequel. Jet Set Radio Future is a sequel.
Oh!
But, you know, it got a 360 port.
I thought it was
port.
Just an enhanced release.
No, it's a full-blown sequel. Like, it's absolutely a step further in terms of design. It's a sequel in every way. But it got a port, you know, to PlayStation 3, and Vita got a port, it got a PC port, and it still resonates with people because it's still a great game. You know, I also, of course, wanted to mention Skies of Arcadia. This was a Japanese RPG about sky pirates in, like, a Final Fantasy-style mode, but with a more of an anime art design. It had a really cool and interesting story, a fairly boilerplate fighting battle system, but still, you know, that game resonates with people. Every time there's a Sega rumor that Sega's going to be revitalizing an IP, there is a huge contingent of gamers that are like, please, please, please be a new Skies of Arcadia. Of course, if you're interested in playing Skies of Arcadia and you can't find a Dreamcast, or you don't have a copy of the game on you, there was also a really great port of it available for the GameCube. Of course, we'd be remiss not to mention Shenmue, which obviously for a lot of people was their first sort of interaction with a 3D open world game. You know, the game notably had some really powerful graphics tech running it. It looks amazing. In its way, it still actually looks quite amazing.
Yeah, it's like, hey, want to go to the vending machine or the arcade?
Yeah, the attention to detail was second to none. You could go to the arcade and play all kinds of, like, really well-emulated Sega classics in the arcade. You could basically live a whole little life without even interacting with the actual game's story. You could get a job as, like, a forklift driver in a warehouse. You could get paid for it. The game actually, because it took place in China, the game actually had, it took place in, like, 1986 or 87. The game's weather patterns in the game actually emulate, like, a year or two of the actual weather patterns of that area of China on a day-by-day basis, since the game had, like, a day-night system. So, the attention to detail was amazing. You could go adopt a kitten, and there was, like, a whole virtual pet thing with the kitten.
Aww.
Right? Just such incredible...
Speaking of pet, I mean, this really was Yu Suzuki-san's pet project, wasn't it?
Oh, this was absolutely his pet project. It was initially going to be, like, a 13-chapter epic. In fact, you know, a lot of people talk about how at the time, Shenmue was the most expensive game ever made. But a big part of that was because they had budgeted, with Chapter 1, sort of a tech backbone for the next 13 games in the series. So they really were very ambitious. They really thought they had a really amazing idea. And, you know, the fact that this game still resonates with people, again, much like Jet Set Radio and Skies of Arcadia, Shenmue is one of those games that it got its hooks in people to the point that 15 years later, we're still talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, it still looks gorgeous. And, I mean, Yu Suzuki-san's still talking about it. You might remember he did the Shenmue postmortem at this year's GDC.
Yeah, well, you know, and you know, that's fed into by the fact that the player base, game culture, like, we all still look at Shenmue really reverently. I mean, this was a 3D open world game before Grand Theft Auto 3. And in a lot of ways, the simulation aspect remains untouched by all comers. Like, no other game does, like, the life sim as completely as Shenmue. With one very notable exception, a lot of the people that worked on Shenmue went on eventually to work on the Ryu ga Gotoku series.
Yeah.
Which, from a design standpoint, is actually very similar. It features, you know, typically a whole real world, like, simulation of Japan. And takes a lot of these, like, themes of, like, attention to detail, and weather patterns, and day-night cycle, and, like, do whatever you want, and you can go to, you know, a strip club, or a kitten parlor.
Hey. A kitten parlor, hey. And I'd rather go to that than a strip club.
So Ryu ga Gotoku Yakuza, if you've ever wondered why the fan base for that game, including myself, are so passionate about that game, it's because it's the closest experience we have on modern hardware to Shenmue.
I honestly have to admit that I forget that strictly speaking, that Ryu ga Gotoku is not a Shenmue, like, spinoff.
Yeah, it's very easy to think of it as a Shenmue spinoff when it's closer to, like, a spiritual successor. But anyway, to keep moving this forward, man, we're gonna end up having to do a spotlight on Shenmue someday. You know, the next game I wanted to talk about, of course, was Crazy Taxi.
I want to go to the KFC.
Oh, I bet you do, girl. You know, Crazy Taxi was...
We still talk about it today and get excited when there's an iOS port.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, a lot of people talk about, like, oh, Crazy Taxi wouldn't have been as memorable without the soundtrack it had. But no, it was incredibly tight game design. The graphics were perfect. It had this really great, like... somewhat cartoony art style that was still, as far as, like, the locations and stuff, were still super, you know, fairly realistic at the time. Like, great graphics that they really took advantage of, like, the draw distance of the Dreamcast / Naomi hardware, which, you know, that's something we'll talk about in a minute. But the simulation of the world around you in Crazy Taxi was just really great, and it became really easy to, like, fall into this game world and get really into it, which I think is why, again, people still talk about Crazy Taxi, even when it's just about shitty mobile ports and sequels, because
I mean, it was, as far as I remember, it was pretty much identical to the arcade version. Like, I mean, in terms of quality.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because, you know, this was actually one of the games that ran on Sega's Naomi hardware that I was, you know, had just mentioned. You know, the Sega Naomi hardware was really interesting in that it was essentially just straight up a Dreamcast.
That's what I thought, yeah.
And so, you know, when you look at a game like Crazy Taxi, the reason why it's arcade perfect is because you are literally playing the arcade game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, from a coding and tech perspective, it's not even really a port. Like, just straight up, you're playing the arcade game in your home.
And it's just, it's on a GD-ROM instead of on a board.
Exactly. And, you know, even then, a lot of the hardware chipsets for arcades that you were seeing at that point, specifically Capcom's CPS line of boards, actually ran on cartridges themselves. So you'd buy, arcade proprietors would have to buy a CPS board, and then they'd buy cartridges to switch in and out, which is why you would see so many CPS cabinets. Like, 1 week an arcade would have, you know, Street Fighter 2, and then the next week it was like, oh, we're not running Street Fighter 2, or, you know, Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo anymore, we're running Darkstalkers something this week. Or, oh, this cabinet is now an Alien vs. Predator cabinet. So this sort of modular design for arcade boards was sort of really in vogue at the time. You know, the Neo Geo MVS, or, I'm sorry, AES system was also designed on this same philosophy. It was MVS was the arcade board, my bad. AES was the home ones, I think. And anyway, you know, they were actually still making Naomi games. Melty Blood was a Naomi game initially. Into the late 2000s, like 2008, I think, was the last Naomi release. So this hardware was actually really widely supported, not just by Sega. Guilty Gear XX was a Naomi game. Dead or Alive 2 was a Naomi game. Marvel vs. Capcom 2 was a Naomi game. And again, you know, that sort of on point of what you were talking about with Crazy Taxi, and we're going to actually talk about a couple of those other games in a minute. The reason why, when you say, you know, oh, it was a great port, it was just like playing in the arcade, again, it's because you were literally playing the arcade version of the game on identical hardware to what the arcade was running.
Yeah.
As an aside, I also always had a huge crush on the character Axel from Crazy Taxi.
Thank you. Did you notice that I had his image pulled up?
I did. That's what made me think about it, man. I used to play that game in the arcade and be like, oh, he gives me feelings.
Right? And it didn't hurt that he had really nicely rendered chiseled body.
LOL. I was really more into his colorful hair and, like, his nonconformist dress.
Yeah, his little bit of scruff and...
Yeah, no, my type. Anyway, I want to talk about another Capcom game. This is Mars Matrix. And if you asked me to rank my favorite games of all time, Mars Matrix would be either number 5 or number 6.
Wow.
Mars Matrix is ostensibly, it's a bullet hell, top-down, 2D, auto-scrolling shooter. Like, shoot 'em
up. Okay, that explains it.
But it has what is, to this day, one of my very favorite mechanics for one of those games. So the game is very, very tightly score-based. It had a chain system where the more points you got, you'd have like a chance to like combo them to get more points and multipliers by killing other enemies and collecting their score drops within a certain time limit. So it became like you had to memorize the correct pattern and the correct skills to use. So high-end play, watching it online on YouTube or whatever is really interesting because perfect clears of this game involve, like, split-second timing windows, using the correct form of your weapon, and also using a really amazing game design that you don't see a lot in that space. This game called it the Mosquito, where basically as enemy fire, like bullet hell style enemy fire is coming at you, you could hold your attack button down in order to create a little shield around you that would catch all of your enemy's bullets. And then, using like a momentum physics system, you could direct where these bullets went by releasing the button while moving in the opposite direction of where you want the bullets to go. It would then fire them back at the enemy and give you an additional score multiplier.
Oh, wow.
If you killed them with those mosquitoed bullets.
There is a CPS2 Mars Matrix cartridge on eBay for $150.
I'm a huge fan of Mars Matrix. I actually own multiple copies of it for Dreamcast because one of my copies I had thought was stolen, but it actually turned out to be in my mom's car under the seat.
Oops.
So I still don't know how it got there, but whatever. I mean, it turned up and now I have two copies, and that's just absolutely one of my favorite games. Cannot get enough Mars Matrix. Which actually brings me to the next game. This was a Dreamcast game that never released in North America. Like the Saturn before it, something that you're going to hear from a lot of Dreamcast enthusiasts is about how amazing the software was worldwide. And this game, you know, became a worldwide phenomenon. Even on the Dreamcast era, because of how piracy was widespread, a lot of people here played it on the Dreamcast and then bought it when it became available commercially for the first time with its GameCube port. I'm talking, of course, about Ikaruga.
Mm-hmm.
Ikaruga is another top-down shmup. It has had ports to the GameCube, to the Xbox 360, to the PC, and it has, you know, I almost feel like it would be a waste of my time to describe it too much, but it uses a really cool, like, color inversion ability where, like, if you're a white ship, black ships are weak to you and white bullets can't hurt you. And then if you press a button, you become a black ship, and then the reverse is true. Black ships can't hurt you, white ships are weak to you. And so the whole game is almost approached in terms of perfect runs as like a puzzle game almost. Like, what color am I supposed to be at what point? What times am I supposed to, you know, switch at really fast? What times do I want to be using black bullets versus white bullets? It's just an incredibly tight design game by Treasure.
Yeah, and you know, this is a game with such a legacy that those of you who were playing World of Warcraft in the Wrath of the Lich King era might remember in the Trial of the Crusader raid, there was the Twin Valkyr fight, and that was basically heavily influenced by Ikaruga. I mean, it was...
I believe Blizzard has even talked about that.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, obviously it was not a shmup, but I mean, using the mechanics of the Black Orbs and the White Orbs, I mean, it was very, very heavily influenced by it.
Yeah, from a design perspective, that was definitely like an Ikaruga inspiration.
Yeah, that was like Captain Spike's favorite WoW fight.
Well, of course it was. It was like Ikaruga, the WoW fight. You know, the next game I want to talk about is Rez. This is another game that did not come out in North America on the Dreamcast, but it did get, you know, a Japanese and EU release, and then it got ports in North America for the PlayStation 2, Xbox 360... I think that might be it, actually. There was some weirdness in terms of it not getting ports to all of the consoles, but either way, we've already talked about. Rez is a on-rails 3D shooter that is very specifically designed around the concept of synthesia. The entire world around you is pulsating with beats and music, and every fire, every target you lock on, every fire you fire, all plays into creating a rhythm and music as you play. You know, this, of course, also had the somewhat notable and infamous peripheral released for it in Japan, the Trance Vibrator, which is exactly what it sounds like.
Did you import it?
I actually never found found a Trance Vibrator.
They were all used, and you were like, nope.
LOL. You know, the funny thing about that is, the gaming shop, or the import shop I used to go to, always told me that they were gonna get a Trance Vibrator in, and I had told them, like, call me when you do, because I will buy it immediately. But they never got it in. Or they lied to me and were like, oh, it didn't come in.
Now, was the Trance Vibrator intended for that purpose, or was it just kind of ambiguous?
Well, Mizuguchi-san, who made this game, you know, he would often talk about how people had a lot of really clever ideas for where they could put it, that he personally would always put it in a pocket near his heart so he could feel the vibration in his core. The idea being that it would vibrate with the music of the game, but... you know, he did say that they did foresee that happening and it didn't stop them from releasing it.
Yeah.
Which I think is about as close to tacit approval as we're ever gonna get. The next game I want to talk about is Power Stone, but I don't know that we really need to talk too much about it. This was Capcom's take on a fighting game, arena fighting game. Power Stone 1 was two-player, and, you know, it was in a 3D arena, very heavily anime-inspired character designs, you know, some brawler aspects, as well as, you know, the titular Power Stone, which, when you would collect all of the fragments of Power Stone, you'd become like a Super Saiyan version of your character. With one character, in fact, even getting a tail and blonde hair and everything. So, I mean, it was a pretty clear analog. Really, though, I think what most people remember when they talk about Power Stone is really Power Stone 2, which takes all of the successful ideas from the first Power Stone and puts them together to make an even more amazing package. You know, something we didn't talk about the Dreamcast is that it had four controller ports, much like the Nintendo 64 before it. And so Power Stone 2 was a four-player version of Power Stone. It had better graphics, better tech. The arcade version, again, was a Naomi game. I don't know that there was an arcade version of the first Power Stone. I'd be interested in hearing from any of our listeners if they ever saw one. My first experience with Power Stone 2 was actually at Circus in Reno, playing with Seawolf Jason. We were there with his parents. And they had an arcade cabinet of Power Stone 2, and we must have played that one day for 13 or 14 hours straight. Because we just had endless tokens, and we just played nonstop. We didn't really play any other game that day. And when that game came out at home, we bought it, and we had Power Stone parties basically every night for a long time. You know, the same way that we were playing my import N64 cartridge of Smash Brothers 64 a year or two prior, that was the same space that Power Stone 2 inhabited for us. Just an amazing game. The Power Stone series is another one that we're all still really passionate about. Clearly had a real impact. Again, one of those games that anytime Capcom is talking about revitalizing an old IP, Power Stone comes up. And the real criminal aspect of that is the original Power Stone and Power Stone 2 are available on Dreamcast. They did a port of both of those games for the PSP, and that's it. Like, those are the only two places you can play these games, are like PSP or Dreamcast. They're, for whatever reason, even though a port of Power Stone 2 would be the perfect Xbox Live Marketplace or PSN title or eShop title, there has not been any support of that game in that space.
Mm.
The next game to talk about, of course, is one of my personal favorites. Definitely a top 10 of all time for me. And again, you know, that's something to think about. A lot of Dreamcast games are in my top 10. My top 10 is primarily like SNES and Dreamcast. But that, of course, is Space Channel 5. Ta-da! Yeah, so, you know, Space Channel 5, rhythm game, has CGI backgrounds with real-time rendered polygon characters rendered over it to create sort of like a really impressive display in its era. The timing windows were super tight. Tight enough that playing these games on Dreamcast on an HD TV is basically impossible. But man, just an incredible experience. Amazing music. The character designs and settings and scenarios were just over the top and so much fun. Main character Ulalop does persist today. She's a well-loved character. And funny enough, you know, Sega was putting so much advertising effort into the Dreamcast after its successful launch that she actually was a host at the VMAs that year. A presenter at the VMAs that year. And, you know, you would see copies of Space Channel 5 popping up in the backgrounds of popular movies of the era, such as, like, Josie and the Pussycats.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Sega really tried to make that game pop and happen. And this seems silly now, but at the time it was a big deal. They had professional voice acting from, like, well-known internet celebrities. In this case, of course, it was the live-action anime girl Apollo Smile doing the voice for Ulala. Just an amazing package. You've probably played it, but a really sad thing to me, the original Space Shuttle 5 had a 360 port. Space Shuttle 5 2, which never came to the North America territories on the Dreamcast, it did get a release in EU and Japan. That game got a port to PlayStation 2,
right.
Xbox 360, and Steam. For some reason, Space Channel 5 part 1 has not been released on Steam, so your best bet is probably the Xbox 360 port. I believe that's available both in the Dreamcast collection that Sega did for Xbox 360, as well as the Xbox Live Arcade.
Right.
Probably if you're listening to the show, you already know what makes that game amazing. So I want to talk about the last game on my little list, and that is Marvel vs. Capcom 2. This, of course, was a hugely popular game, in a lot of ways revitalized the fighting game scene, even though the game is super poorly balanced. And in a lot of ways, I think a lot of the current excitement of Evo, etc., fighting games in general, really has its roots in how enormously successful and popular Marvel vs. Capcom 2 was. At the time, it was a big deal that the game had 56 playable fighters, and amazing technical performance, because again, you know, the arcade version was running on Naomi, so in a lot of ways, you know, we were playing a 2D Capcom fighter using literally the exact same tech that was running the arcade version. And I know I keep running back to that point, but, you know, this game and this console really happened in a time where arcades were still popular. Like, it was in that sort of window where arcades fell out of popularity, but you know, a lot of these games that we loved had their roots in the arcade, and we were finally getting the real versions of them at home. Like, not remakes, not ports, not, you know, oh, this is like a downport, this is a reimagining. Like, no, we were just playing the arcade game at home. It was absolutely a huge change for the industry and for gamers in general.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we really don't see that anymore because I guess maybe the state of arcade gaming, but you know, everything is such its own dedicated hardware that you're probably not going to experience anything like that again.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, we do occasionally see arcade games coming out with, you know, Nintendo has done a few arcade games, F-Zero AX, the Mario Kart games. These all run on modified home hardware, arcade boards that, much like the Naomi, are based around Nintendo hardware. So, or, you know, the home hardware of the manufacturer at the time. So, you know, there's certainly some parallels there, but, Slaggy, you mentioned that you had some games that you had noticed I hadn't listed.
Yeah.
Why don't you bring some of those up?
The first one is Choo Choo Rocket.
Oh, snap, yeah.
It's just a little cutie puzzler, which had online capabilities, and you were trying to move the Choo Choos, which were little adorable mice, around a board and avoid the captor called Kapu Kapus from trying to get you. There's also a fun multiplayer mode where you would try to direct mice into rockets and cat into other players' rockets.
Oh, wow, that's shady. And, you know, it's interesting because this was a Yuji Naka game. This was actually made by Sega Team.
Sonic Team?
Yeah, yeah, this was actually made by Sonic Team.
And then the other one is Semen.
Yeah, you're quite right. I totally forgot about Semen.
Ironic that.
We are not talking about this word in the
no,
sex way.
No, of course
way.
Not. We're talking about the virtual pet game that was one of the few games to use the official Dreamcast microphone. And it was probably the most famous game that Yuji Saito-san...
Yeah, previously popular for, like, Sega Tower and Ute Tower.
Yeah, so it's one of his most legendary games.
The English language version, of course, was voiced by Leonard Nimoy.
That's right.
And, you know, something that's interesting, we actually talked about this on Game Buoy, is that a lot of people still talk about Seaman enough that there was actually a 3DS revival announced, although we've never heard anything about it since announcement.
Right.
It's almost certainly dead now, unfortunately.
Yeah,
but
it did get a PS2 sequel in Japan only.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it had a port for the PlayStation 2, the first game did. Unfortunately, it was supposed to come to PC, but that never made it. And, you know, Seaman was a crazy game. You'd use the mic to talk to your Seaman, and he would talk back to you.
Yeah.
Like almost like an enhanced one-step-further version of Pikachu Genki Dachu.
Right.
And the Leonard Nimoy narration, if you've never seen this game, I would highly recommend that you check it out on YouTube or something. Seaman is spelled S-E-A-M-A-N. The Leonard Nimoy narration really amps it up. Like, this is already a really surreal experience. You're raising, like, a fish with a human face.
It's Yuji Saito-san's face.
And the Leonard Nimoy narration just turns it into this really surreal experience. Like, it's like creepy and funny and uncomfortable. It's just, it's a really strange and incredible experience. And you know, again, it's interesting that you brought those games up, Slagkick, because even though these are games that have not gotten a ton of ports, they've not gotten releases and sequels and re-releases left and right, people still 15 years later know what these games are, talk about them, have really strong emotional opinions about them. So, you know, again, it's just really one of those things where, like with all things Dreamcast, this console and these games had a huge impact.
Now, I'm curious, I'm sure that you're probably familiar with Christmas Semen. Do you know if Christmas Semen had any additional content, or was it just the special edition Dreamcast?
You know, I'm actually not super familiar with Christmas Semen. I know that it came out. My understanding was that it had, like, Christmas hats and music, but I couldn't say that for sure. I do know that it was kind of a big deal. You know, Sega did a Christmas Nights for the Sega Saturn.
Uh-huh.
They also did a Christmas downloadable theme for Sonic Adventure on the Dreamcast.
We should do a Christmas Micro.
Maybe.
Would you say...
I'd be surprised if Christmas Semen didn't have the music and the hats.
Would
that
you say
I've
overall
of,
that you would consider Semen one of the most seminal experiences on the Dreamcast?
So, you know, we really talk about the impact.
You're not even going to acknowledge that, are you?
We talk a lot about the impact of the Dreamcast, both from the perspective of being fans and gamers and lovers of game design and interesting new ideas in software that are put forward. But it's really worth mentioning, you know, to really that from a tech aspect, the Dreamcast has had a legacy as well. We've already talked about how, you know, their approach to their arcade hardware, Naomi, and using the same GD-ROM format for the arcade boards that their home console used, that, you know, that was a big deal that we've seen people talk about. We've seen people follow suit with, including Nintendo, with the F-Zero arcade game and the Mario Kart arcade games, which all run on, you know, effectively like Wii GameCube style technology, to the point that you can emulate those games on the Wii. But, you know, we didn't really talk necessarily about how, you know, Jet Set Radio really brought cel shading to the public's eyes. Mm-hmm. And if you remember, there was practically an era of gaming where every game was cel shaded, yep, including that Zelda.
Yep.
You know, but it's also worth mentioning it was the first console that every unit, every model shipped with a modem. You know, it's just a shitty dial-up modem, although there was a broadband modem available. But you would be able to take games, even including launch titles like Sonic Adventure, and download DLC for them.
That's crazy.
And a lot of people really, I mean, think about it. Sonic Adventure was a game in 1999 where you could go online with Sonic Adventure and download a holiday theme that would make the city have like little like snowflakes and wreaths and stuff. Like there, it had a Halloween theme. You know, some of these games, like Samba de Amigo, which we didn't talk about really.
Oh, yeah.
It had downloadable songs that you could go onto SegaNet and download. SegaNet was like the Dreamcast's online service. And, you know, so really, I mean, you think about that impact. The Dreamcast, out of the box, had support for online multiplayer, which was taken advantage of with games like Phantasy Star Online, which is huge. A lot of people look at that now as like the birth of MMO-style gameplay on the console space. You know, and that was another enormously popular game with huge impact. And again, modem shipped right in the package as a part of the hardware. The hardware launched at like an affordable, what, like $199? So it cost less than the generation of consoles before it. We don't see that a whole lot. So, you know, it's just really amazing forethought, foresight into where the industry was going. And you saw that again also with the way that the memory cards for the Dreamcast plugged into the controller of the Dreamcast. But these memory units were actually called VMUs, and the V stood for visual, because every memory unit had on it a little LCD screen, as well as, like, controls, so that you could play mini games that would relate to your game saves on the go, and it would act as a second screen functionality in certain games while playing.
Yeah.
Most notably, you know, the Resident Evil series, rather than having to pause to get your lifeline health meter, you could just look down at your VMU and it would display in real time what your health status was, not at all dissimilar to what we're seeing come out of Nintendo with 3DS, 3DS, and Wii U. So, I mean, really, again, there were some really forward-thinking ideas with the Dreamcast. And, you know, sort of from a less of a tech standpoint, but another software standpoint, like with the cel shading, is that Shenmue is also considered the first game to feature QuickTime events. Well, you know, whatever you think about QuickTime events, you know, most games have them these days. And that was another thing that started on a Sega-made Dreamcast title. I would, of course, argue that you could trace that back even a little bit further and get to, like, Die Hard Arcade slash, what were they called at home? Dynamite Deca? Which was another Sega series. Also had, you know, a lot of the same people involved where, you know, in production. But again, the entire, like, this is a cinema, as it's playing, you have to hit a button or, you know, fail or have, like, a, you know, a different win situation once you regain control of your characters. That was a Dreamcast era invention, more or less. So, I just think it's really fascinating to think about. So the last thing I really want to talk about here, and then we can move on because we've actually been going a long time now, is I want to talk a little bit about the cost and value of getting into Dreamcast gaming now. You know, as with all of these things, we've talked about where you can play more modern ports of these games that we've mentioned here. But there's still some value. Unlike a lot of these older consoles, there's still some value in getting into Dreamcast gaming, in my opinion. Especially if you want to have, like, a Power Stone party, which I think is absolutely worth doing. You know, I checked up on the cost of Dreamcasts. They can be had for under $50. A lot of even the best games can be had for $20 or less for reasons I'll never understand. But I wanted to get your opinion, Slaggy, because I know that you bought a Dreamcast maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
I think it might have been a little longer than that at this point.
Why don't you talk about that experience?
Yeah, I actually was able to pick one up at GameStop for $15. So, unfortunately, that time is coming gone. This was pre-Game Buoy. But, it was definitely a worthwhile investment. And, you know, I do have to say that, unfortunately, though piracy killed the Dreamcast in a lot of ways. If there are, like, hard to track down games, you know, it is very easy, like you said, to experience this sort of thing. And, you know, I mean, I think my stance on it is kind of like ROMs for hard to find games for classic consoles, you know. If there is a reasonable way to buy it and support, you know, and to keep piracy out of the seas, then that's best. But, you know, for those who are unable to locate certain games, you know, that kind of, it's taking a negative thing and kind of turning it to an advantage.
Yeah, I suppose so. And, you know, there are so many Dreamcast games, and so many of them, you know, we didn't even talk about here on this episode. You know, they had Grandia 2, which was a sequel to the well-loved Saturn JRPG, which, before anyone bites my head off, did get a PS1 port. But that PS1 port was awful GDI. You know, it had the amazing Giga Wings series. It had some Castle of Shikigami shooter games. You know, obviously, we briefly mentioned House of the Dead 2. You know, there was stuff like Cannon Spike, which we'll talk about a little bit during our feedback section. Dead or Alive 2, it had an entry in the super successful Japanese Densha de Go series. It had ports of all of the older Resident Evil games, as well as an original Resident Evil game, Resident Evil Code Veronica, which remains one of the most well-loved Resident Evil games. It had some really amazing 3D beat-em-up fighter hybrid games, one of which we've actually featured here on Game Buoy, Spawn in the Demon's Hand, as well as its pseudo-sequel based on a different comic book license, Heavy Metal Geomatrix. You know, there was a ton of SNK Neo Geo support in terms of ports with Goro, Mark of the Wolves, Last Blade 2, the King of Fighters series had like 5 different iterations on this thing in those 2 years. You know, it was just such an amazing console. And I mean, I guess I'm just wrapping up just by saying, if you're interested in Dreamcast gaming, a lot of these experiences cannot be had on any other platform for this price with this performance. You can get, you know, like virtual console releases of some of the Neo Geo games that came out that got amazing arcade perfect Dreamcast ports. But a lot of this stuff, if you're interested in playing it, even now, the Dreamcast is pretty much the only way to go. So I would definitely recommend, if you're interested, just checking out local import shops or game shops. I don't know if, you know, how many of you all out there have retro game stores near you. I'm very lucky that I have like 5 of them in a 30-mile radius of me. But if you have any near you, by all means, check out the Dreamcast section. You know, you won't regret it. There are just so many amazing games. Epping Project Justice is one of my favorite fighting games of all time. It's a sequel to Rival Schools United by Fate. Only available on the Dreamcast. It's never been ported. And last I heard, even emulating it is not well emulated. So just, I can't possibly recommend highly enough, if you're interested in these kinds of games, give the Dreamcast a look. You won't regret it.
Yeah.
Slaggy, do you have any final thoughts?
Just that, you know, despite its sad demise, that it's still very well loved. I think you could tell that by not only our discussion of it, but your responses that we'll get to in a few minutes. And just really that, you know, we're glad that Sega's doing okay now, but it could have been a rebirth for them. And it's so kind of tragic to think how it all ended up. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right, well.
Yeah, I half expect that we'll be getting deeper into the Sega saga in the future.
The Sega saga. But yes, I suspect we will.
You know, it's the 20th anniversary of the Japanese Saturn launch this year, and 20th anniversary of the Saturn North American launch next year.
I don't think we'll do a Saturn episode,
probably
maybe.
Not.
But maybe.
I was just pointing out, it's a very anniversary sort of era for Sega right now.
All right, well, with all of this having been said and done, let's start our wrap-up with a little bit of...
Rumor has it.
All right. Well, first up, we have here a rumor that I'm very, very excited about. So, at the Mighty Number 9 panel at PAX last week, there were flyers handed out that were sort of done in the style of classic video game magazines, with like tips and tricks on a handful of current Intic Creates related and Mighty Number 9 related games, which also included a free download code for Mighty Gunvolt, interestingly enough. But something interesting is that on the back side, there was one page of advertisement. And interestingly, despite all of these flyers having the same front page, there are two different versions of the back page that, when you line them up side by side, give the appearance of being a 90s-style video game magazine advertisement. The advertisement is interesting because it has the theme of There Will Be Blood, and it has this whole description for a game that, as far as we know, doesn't exist. Except, when you read the description, it sounds an awful lot like one of the Igarashi-era DS Metroidvania-style Castlevanias. You know, because of the form that this takes out, where it's like the style of like an old video game magazine ad that's been torn out of a magazine, the space in the ad that references its world-famous game creator, unfortunately, that part of the text has been ripped out. As well as the line that would have said the name of the game.
Yeah, they kind of flopped a little bit on this because then the rest of it should just line up, like, right matched up.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, I think it's intentional on their part, like, to make sure that people recognize that they're playing a game here. Because again, it's very clear that they went out of their way to ignore not mention the name of the game creator or the name of the game, because all of the rest of the text lines up perfectly. But, you know, again, what that really means here is that we have another game creator working with these folks to bring back a classic series, is what this looks like. And based on the in-game art, probably concept art of what they want the in-game art to look like, displayed here in the corners of the advertisement, we have little old SD television sets displaying what really looks like basically Castlevania art. We have like a European-looking castle with a giant moon in the background with a shadowy tower in front of it. There's a bridge leading up to the castle. We have some clouds passing in front of the moon. Like, if you just listen to that description, that's a Castlevania level. But there's also a really interesting, like, field in a different piece of art with, you know, some Japanese temple structures.
Mm-hmm.
So we are probably looking at the new game by Koji Igarashi-san. And there's a lot of hype about this because it's almost certainly going to be a Metroidvania-style game, free from the shackles and burdens that come with the Castlevania franchise.
And now, because this was at the Inafune panel, are we thinking that Igarashi-san is working with Concept? Because, I mean, how amazing would that be?
Well, you know, it's worth mentioning, Igarashi-san, when he left Konami, had said very specifically that he was going to need to reach out for help from a more business-minded game developer, because he himself didn't have a mind for those kinds of politics and that kind of business. So to me, because that's what the guys over at Concept are all about, you know, Inafune-san, specifically, you know, while he is also a programmer and designer, he has gone on the record as saying he does primarily view himself also as a businessman.
Oh my god, did you see on this thread that they were looking at the runes? And it says, what a wonderful night to have a kiss, K-S.
Oh, wow.
What a wonderful night to have a Kickstarter.
Almost certainly, man. That's great. You know, we're looking at a thread on NeoGAF here. Specifically, they based this thread on a tweet made by Jose Otero.
From 1UP, right?
Well, I was just gonna say, he used to be from 1UP, he's now an associate editor at IGN, and he hosts the Nintendo Voice Chat podcast. And this thread, I guess, since I first saw it, you're saying that they have uncovered additional information. That's great. And you know, there was a line in the copy here, which we didn't discuss, that refers to turning your world upside down, which many people view as a Castlevania reference. Especially because the specific line is, the all-new adventure that will turn your world upside down, what else would you expect from world-famous game creator blank? Which, like, yeah, that's a Castlevania Igarashi reference. So, knowing that these runes have been translated to, what a wonderful night to have a kiss... First off, that's clearly a reference to what a horrible night to have a curse. Also, Kickstarter. My hope is that Comcept is working with Igarashi to get the business part down, and that IntiCreates is working with him to create a solid, beautiful 2D side-scrolling Metroidvania-style non-Castlevania game.
Or not even, doesn't even have to be a Metroidvania.
Shut your whore mouth.
You wouldn't want it to be like a stage-based one?
F that.
It would likely be a Metroidvania.
No. You know, and specifically here in the copy, it references using alchemy to create new weapons and stuff. So I don't see how that kind of game design would work in a stage-based Castlevania anyway. I've talked about this here when we had our Castlevania episode. I definitely prefer Metroidvania-style game design to stage-based.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely Symphony of the Night. That was the first one that I really found appealing to me from a gameplay's perspective.
Yeah, I think that's true for a lot of people. Anyway, we're super excited because I think this is the first time we've had a rumor that we've talked about for more than 5 minutes.
I mean, it's just like two visionaries in gaming coming together, if that's really true.
Yeah, and I tell you, man, you know, that was an IntiCreates heavy panel. If they are working on the new Igavania-style game, this is going to be something that you're really going to want to pay attention to.
I mean, can you basically imagine if eventually Kojima-san left Konami, and then he and Inafune and Igarashi-san all teamed up with Platinum Games?
Okay, now you're fan-wanking.
Yes, I am.
So let's move on to this next rumor we have. Trophies for a PlayStation 4 port of Beyond Two Souls have popped up, so we are almost certainly getting a port of Beyond Two Souls for PlayStation 4. We've also had a few German retail game sites post on their sites in their stores for a Beyond Two Souls PS4 Director's Cut. So, more likely than not, that's what we're going to be getting here. And I say bring it on, you know. Beyond Two Souls was a surprisingly pleasant experience, but since it came right at the tail end of the PS3's lifespan, I think a lot of people probably did give it a fair go.
Yeah.
It's not my normal style of game, but I'll be honest, I really quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, and it would probably be a nice way to tide us over until whatever Quantic Dream's working on. You know, they did that tech demo for the Dark Sorcerer, which we don't know if that's going to be anything like their new game, but, you know, this will keep Quantic Dream fans satisfied for a while, I guess.
Excellent. You know, we may or may not have mentioned here that Europe is getting a special edition 3DS XL based on Smash Brothers. I believe we did, because I think I commented that I don't really care for the art on it. But something that is really interesting is that a supposed leaked Walmart ad for the sales period of the end of September, so presumably we'll actually start seeing this soon and we'll know if this is true or not, North America is supposedly getting this unit of 3DS XL on September 19th.
Yeah.
Now, that is, of course, earlier than it's going to be releasing in Europe. In Europe, it's coming out at the same time as the game itself, and it comes with the game pre-installed on it.
Yeah.
If it came out in North America on the 19th, we would not be getting that version with the game included, which is unfortunate, but I would take it. I would probably buy that, even though I think it's kind of ugly.
Yeah.
It would still
now,
be
I
cool.
thought this was the art that was on one of the new 3DS.
This art is on the Japanese new 3DS LL.
Oh, and they're just doing the XL version here.
But in North America, yeah, and Europe, for sure Europe, and probably North America, this art is going to be on an original 3DS XL.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of it.
Yeah, I just have been thinking lately that it would be nice to upgrade to an XL, so.
Okay, but you're also going to be playing it in Japanese in a few days.
That is true. All right, and last, but certainly not least in our rumor roundup, we are beginning to see reports pop up that both Google and Tencent are talking to Ouya about a potential Ouya acquisition. We don't necessarily have a whole lot more to go on than that, other than, you know, we've been hearing a lot about the Ouya experimenting in various ways to make money. Who knows how any of these experiments are going, because they're not very forthcoming with their sales projections and sales numbers and stuff. But it is very interesting to think that they could end up being acquired and be a foothold into, for example, Microsoft, into Amazon having a proper console rather than just the Kindle TV. And Tencent, right, of course, has been acquiring all kinds of different game companies, including Riot Games. So, you know, it's interesting to think. We don't normally report on these kinds of things super often, but in this case, this really does seem like a where there's smoke, there's fire situation.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and you know, there's the whole thing with the Chinese ban on foreign consoles finally being lifted. So the Tencent deal could be, I mean, there could be some credibility for that.
Yeah, it would make sense for Tencent to try and make an acquisition at this time.
And then, hey, League of Legends Ouya edition.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, you know, I want to move on. We have two smashes this week, two articles that we really recommend you read in terms of games journalism and being well-written, well-researched, and just, you know, having a good point to them. Slagkick, this first one was one that you specifically wanted to talk about, so why don't you take over for me?
Yeah, this one was published over on Kotaku by Stephen Totillo, and the title is just About Gamergate. And as far as I can tell, the only other gaming site that has run anything about this Gamergate poopstorm, for lack of a better word, was a Eurogamer op-ed that was kind of just about, like, an open letter that had been going around. But this is the only one that really seemed to address it, and not in a sensationalist way. And, I mean, also it kind of stands out that within the post itself are links to kind of Kotaku's coverage of the events unfolding. So really just kind of, first of all, being a very well-handled response to the Gamergate controversy without resorting to, like, name-calling. You know, it's a very respectful way of saying, you know, that this is not cool. I mean, that, you know, it's without being sensationalist is the best way to say it. Which is very hard, which is why I feel like it would be very difficult for us to have a proper episode about this topic, because I'm still very heated about this, and, you know, our goal here on Game Buoy is to try and, you know, trying to report things to you, you know, well thought out. And
I need to make the official Game Buoy statement on this. I know I kind of did that a week or two ago, but I really need to reiterate here. I've done my very best to minimalize the amount of coverage we've given this topic and this supposed debate, because honestly, this angle, this campaign, it's been a ruse, really, for some really super misogynistic people to basically shut slut shame Anita Sarkeesian and Zoe Quinn. If you don't believe that, you are wrong. And let me make sure to reiterate, those of you who bought the organizers of this campaign's pitch that this was really about fighting corruption in games journalism, I appreciate that. I'm right there with you. For the last 2.5 years, we here at GameBuoy.org have been all about decrying the wretched state of games journalism. We have seen all kinds of payola schemes and payout to various sites and blogs for positive coverage of games that didn't deserve it. Just last year, we had the whole Jeff Keighley Doritos Gate and yeah. Mountain Dew.
I mean, hasn't
but
that...
you know what? Where was the big brigade of men
right.
decrying that? Where were was the people saying, hey, you're obviously taking kickback for positive promotional consideration?
I mean, really, this is something that's been going on since the days of print me, too.
Oh, certainly. It's always been the way games journalism has worked, because games
the way
journalism...
That the music industry works, and
games,
et cetera, et cetera.
Games journalism, even more than the other forms of media, started out specifically as a form of advertisement. If you don't think Nintendo Power and Sega Visions were basically sales catalogs in the form of editorial, then I'm sorry, but you're wrong. So, now, don't get me wrong. I think that it is a great idea to fix games journalism, to apply pressure to games journalists to do things right. That is literally a big part of what we have been about on this show for a long time. But, whether Zoe Quinn was the girlfriend of a Kotaku reporter after Depression Quest came out has nothing to do with anything else.
No, it has to do with her ex being jealous.
Her ex posted on 4chan about how she cheated with other people in the games industry on him while they were together, and he posted her private nude pictures that she had sent to him in trust so that they could all slut-shame her and gang up on her and ruin her reputation and the reputation of her game. This has nothing to do with a larger corruption, because if it did, wouldn't the person who should be at fault be her ex-boyfriend, whom worked at Kotaku, and when he got mad that she cheated on him, did all these things? I'm sorry, look, whether she cheated on him or not is none of my business. I would never make my choices in entertainment or gaming based on someone's personal relationships with other people, and frankly, neither should you. Now, if you think Kotaku did something wrong in letting one of their reporters, reviewers, whatever, date her, that is on Kotaku. That is not on Zoe Quinn. And I'm going to argue in favor of Kotaku here, they didn't let him write about the game anymore after their relationship started. Anything he wrote about the game happened before they were dating. So again, this has all been, and I can't even say clever manipulation, because I was going to say, oh, this has been clever manipulation.
It's twisted manipulation.
But no, it's just been, this is people playing games so that they can attack women who they think made quote unquote unethical choices. Regardless of what you think about those choices though, they shouldn't come into gaming, period.
Mm-hmm.
Gamergate is a lie. Don't get me wrong.
I think a lot of it's also based out of a fear of, not a fear, but a desire to silence female voices in the industry.
Oh, well, I mean, I think that that's a big part of sort of how Gamergate got bigger, because it was initially this group that just specifically wanted to attack Zoe Quinn and her associates.
That's not a game.
Primarily by dudes who don't see their games as games, and that's the larger group of people that clung on to this. Are not people with a personal vendetta against Zoe Quinn at all. It was people who then it was like, oh, I don't like these kinds of quote-unquote games, garbaging up our games space. Then the movement became, theoretically, about cleaning up games journalism corruption. The real irony here is that these people that ended up getting attacked, the Maddie Bryces of the world, the Samantha Allen, these people who are doing games journalism from this independent angle, these intelligent female voices in games journalism and indie games right now, like, some of whom have now been driven out of games writing forever because they have been attacked, they've had their personal information posted online, they have been stalked and harassed and had to go to the police for threats. These were the people that were doing what you claim to want to do, taking non-biased stances against corruption in games and really reporting on actual information within the games industry that we all need, giving us voices and insights that we don't currently have access to. And you people, and I assume some of you are well-intentioned, I really want to believe that most of you are well-intentioned, are being led to do what is exactly against what you think you're doing. You're silencing the exact voices that are the only ones doing what you say you want. So, we're always gonna have to be against that here on Game Buoy.
Yeah.
And I'm not gonna make this every episode about this, and I know I said last time that I wasn't gonna comment on this any further, but, I was reminded recently that, evil thrives when, good people don't speak up against it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have to be clear, if you listen to Game Buoy and you align yourself with the Gamergate, I want you to really stop and think about why you align yourself with that cause, and think about what that cause has actually done, rather than what they claim to do.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you, there is actual room to disagree with any of these people. You absolutely can have an intelligent discourse about why you think Anita Sarkeesian's entire thesis is bunk, or why you think the way she does her research is flawed, or why you think the way she presents her information is unintuitive and misleading. Those are valid conversations to have. The correct way to respond to her is not to put out her private information and, start tweeting her that you are going to come to her house and sexually attack her until she dies.
Right.
So, Gamergate is not about fixing discourse. It is about attacking minority voices to shove them out of the game's space. And even if you go against, the Zoe Quinns and the Anita Sarkeesians, by all means, set up a blog and write intelligent discourse about why you disagree with them.
Right. Use your voice.
Use your voice. Don't give your voice to a cause that is going to use it for something nefarious.
Yeah, I got a tweet that when I was talking about this on my personal Twitter, saying basically that I was willfully ignorant and uninformed about it. I'm like, I'm a gaming podcaster who's participated at a convention specifically devoted to try and get rid of this sort of inequity in gaming. Yeah, I'm willfully ignorant. I just responded with a what, though.
Yeah.
I want to point out that if the whole point of Gamergate really was to affect change in games journalism, there was a commenter over on this Kotaku article who was, he started out with a quote, which I think is from the West Wing, about an alleged legend of Andrew Jackson, the president, having a block of cheese that weighed 2 tons, and that Andrew Jackson would invite people into the White House and listen to their problems. And so this commenter was saying, why can't Kotaku have a big block of cheese day post? And that, you know, if people had issues with Kotaku, they could present them intelligently, and then the, Kotaku staff could respond to it and, you know, not always be, addressed all the time, but, you know, at least just acknowledged and set up that discourse. And two of the columnists at Kotaku, Jason Schreier and Nathan Grayson, both said, hey, that's a really cool idea, and we'll pass it along to Totillo. So, I mean, if Kotaku really does follow through with this, like, what a great way for them to, to really push change forward. Because I have to say, I feel bad at this point saying Lol Taku of the Week.
Official Game Buoy statement number 2 this episode. Kotaku is no longer on our poop... I guess I should call it on our dung list.
Ah!
There was a lot of skepticism when Stephen Totillo took over Kotaku. Totillo came from Multiplayer over at MTV's blogs when they had a tech blog focused on video gaming, Multiplayer. And that was a really renowned and considered, intelligent resource for gaming blogs and editorial content. So, we thought for sure Kotaku would clean up. It didn't clean up as fast as we thought. But at this point, it feels safe to say, Totillo really has guided that ship back on course. While some of the content on Kotaku, to me, is still negative and not very good, I do have to say, by and large, I think that they're making a lot of really great steps. I think they've been publishing a lot of really great content of late, and I'm really, really happy to see that, we here on the show, we've always talked about how we want to see these guys doing better, and I think it's now safe to say, take a step back and look at Kotaku, and you can safely say they're doing better now. I want to get to my next smash now, because this is, again, we've right. gone off on quite a bit here, but my other smash is going to go over to US Gamer. They did an article called Your Voice Matters, How Fans Revive Final Fantasy Type-0 for the West, and maybe Dragon Quest VII as well. And this is an interview with Hajime Tabata-san, with Jeremy Parrish and Kat Bailey, where they basically just talk about, how... Oh, also Miyake-san from Square Enix is there, which is one of the executive producers on Dragon Quest VII. And they basically just go on about how, they've been influenced by fan voices and listening to, petitions and hashtag campaigns, and that these things really had opened their eyes to the fact that Type-0 could still be successful. And then they sort of asked specifically for US Gamer to let gamers know they're listening, and if we want Dragon Quest VII, just to let them know, because they want to bring the game over, but it's such a big undertaking that they're not sure that it will be profitable. They're not sure there's interest. But, they want to be proven wrong. They want to be shown interest. And this to me is the most encouraging thing. And this to me, it really reflects, sort of the ongoing dialogue we've had here on Game Buoy about using your voice. And about, how games journalism needs to adapt to include readers' voices a bit.
Yeah.
So this article to me was really just the synthesis of a lot of different ideas that I think have been starting to come up over the last few years.
Indeed.
Alright, well, with all of that having been said, it's time for...
I said, hey, what's going on?
All right, well, I don't really have a lot going on in my terms of my gaming week this past week, because I've mostly been playing the games that I played last week.
Me too.
I'm still working on WoW.
Yep, same here.
And I'm still working on Mighty Gunvolt, Azure Striker Gunvolt, but you're not on that one, are you?
Nope.
Gunvolt continues to impress. I still love it. Doing challenges within every stage to grind out mats for all of the gear that you can craft. A lot of fun to me. Just a really impressive game. The more I play it, the more I like it. WoW, of course, is WoW. You already know what you think about it. So, Slaggy McWaggy, unless you have anything special to say about WoW, I think we're just gonna...
Not particularly. I'm just kind of working on my legendary questline. Just trying to do... There's not really going to be anything notable to say until I make some headway with that.
So that'll probably be next episode, TBH. All right, well, that's enough for that then. Why don't we get over to social links?
Yes, and as we launch into our social links this week, I'd like to remind you that you're always free to tweet at GameBuoy.org.
At GameBuoy.org.
With the .org spelled D-O-T-O-R-G.
With the .org spelled out D-O-T-O-R-G.
For any older answers from questions of the week or response to other episodes, for you backlog babbies out there in internet.
Backlog babbies.
So with that, I'd like to launch into our question of the week this week, which was, this week we're celebrating the Dreamcast. It's been 15 years since the North American release. What was your experience with the DC? Did you pick it up on $99.99? What are your favorite Dreamcast games? We'll start over on Google Plus, which is kind of like the Sega Saturn of social networks. Colin M., better known as the Book Pirate, said, 1999, I would have been 15 at the time. Me too. It was a system that I bought on my own and didn't have to share with my siblings. I didn't have to buy games that we could all play. I bought games for me and me alone. Also, I might have some issues sharing with others. Space Channel 5, Skies of Arcadia, Fantasy, Star Online, Seaman, Crazy Taxi. The Dreamcast had a strong hand in the development of my gaming taste, and I consider it my favorite... And I consider it my favorite gaming system of all time. Wow.
Damn right.
I think of Colin the Book Pirate as a big Microsoft fan, but I didn't know that. So very cool. Thank you for sharing. Over on Twitter, Your Enzyme said, I didn't have a DC until recently. Loved playing Sonic Adventure and Soul Calibur at my friend's house, though. Now I've got Sonic Adventure, SNK versus Capcom, Shenmue, and Blue Stinger, lol.
SNK versus Capcom, and particularly SNK versus Capcom 2, are both so amazing.
And need to get a Frame Meister or something, though.
Yeah.
Over on the Book of Faces... Some of the faces possibly looking like Yu Saito. We're going to start off with John P., better known as Wicked from the Nerdgasm Network and the Gaming Over Takeover podcast. Shortened to the point, I never owned a Dreamcast, sadly, but my overall experience could be said with six words. Power Stone at Captain Spike's house. I mean, we knew that response was coming, yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the first times I ever met Wicked was involving Powered Stone.
That's probably true. I think that's probably true for a lot of people that know Wicked, TBH.
Rob Roberts from the Voice of Geeks Network on such shows as OLR and Horde House said, I picked up a Dreamcast when they were like $40, hee-hee. But at least I got to experience the amazing early console MMO Phantasy Star Online. I'm very excited to play PSO again very soon. It's being relaunched where they give everyone guns and they're calling it Destiny. I hear the little person from Game of Thrones is voicing your mag.
Ah, you shady bitch.
But that just means you think highly of Destiny, right?
Oh, yeah, but actually I think he does, so.
Benjamin L., better known as Space Pirate Ben, said it was always fun to hang out with Captain Spike and play Mars Matrix, Gunbird 2, and Cannon Spike.
Cannon Spike is an amazing game that doesn't get nearly enough credit. I didn't bring it up during our main episode because I wanted to bring it up here. Cannon Spike is like a Final Fight-style brawler in a 3D graphics setting. Based around a handful of famous Capcom characters, Cannon Spike is obviously the name of Cammy's, notable attack. And you could play as Cammy, you could play as Charlie, you could play as Mega Man, you could play as Arthur, you could play as BB Hood / Boletta from Darkstalkers. And there are a few original characters as well. And, you sort of went through like a Capcom history, like super lovingly rendered in 3D, playing through, Capcom settings as Capcom characters.
Nice. Amanda R., better known as Bilfa Jalupi, says, my favorite games were Sonic Adventure, Crazy Taxi, Power Stone 1 and 2, Grandia 2, Phantasy Star Online, and Worms Armageddon. I got the Dreamcast the first month it came out because I worked at CompUSA and got one there.
That's notable because they were hard to get. Like, I had mine pre-ordered. If I hadn't, Lord knows when, I would have gotten one.
She continues, I thought the new generation of graphics were amazing compared to the last gen before it. This next gen of consoles hasn't been quite as noticeable, and you have to consider that. That was the first 128-bit system, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get into the bits
but that's the bits and boots of it.
That stops being a really effective measure of power around that point, unfortunately.
Right. But I mean, it was on the level of the PS2, the Xbox, and the GameCube. So I mean, the fact that it hit earlier than all of those really, I think, credit to Sega for, you know, really pushing the tech envelope. Daniel T said, I never owned a Dreamcast, so my personal experience with it is limited, but I have very fond memories of listening to my best friend tell me all about the absurd experiences he had playing Shenmue. Also, the Dreamcast cemented my love for rhythm gaming between Samba de Amigo and Space Channel 5. Fantastic. I love those rhythm games as well. And Brad B. said, Rob Roberts beat me to it. PSO was my favorite game on the Dreamcast. So as you can see, a lot of love, even from those who didn't own a Dreamcast, or, you know, maybe were very, very late adopters to the console. It is a console that has a lot of love and a very, very strong legacy.
Absolutely. Do we have any more feedback?
No, we don't.
All right, well, I guess it's time for the exit lude.
We love your feedback. We like your iTunes subscriptions, ratings, and reviews.
We like your
Facebook likes.
Like the likes.
We frazzing love Twitter.
Frickin' love Twitter.
Frackin' love Twitter. Tweet, 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 tweet.
Tweet.
You can tumble with us on Tumblr, and Tumble. I just have to be very upfront. I used to be very tumbly. But I have not really been active on Tumblr in really a couple of years, and I do recognize that of all the social networks that the Game Buoy Tumblr is the weakest, so we're going to work on making that a better experience for those of you who like to tumble with us. You can always plus one us on Google Plus, which, as we said, is like the Sega, it's like the Sega Saturn of social networks. You can email us at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
You can mail us at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org! And ever and always, you can reach us at our home base at gamebuoy.org.
Gamebuoy.org.
Where not only will you find the link to all of these social links, but also...
You'll also find a link to the past.
I don't know if you'll find that. Now I have to upload...
Yeah, because there will be a link to all of our previous episodes.
Oh, my God. I was like, am I going to have to upload, like, a picture of a link to the past now?
No, it's already a link to the past.
It is a link to the past and to the future, so we hope that you'll continue to tune in. So with that, we also hope you will tune into these shows. Captain Spike?
As ever and always, I want to shout out to Koopa Club. Koopa Club is an award-winning podcast about Nintendo and gaming with an LGBT twist.
Oh, wow. Did they win the official podcast awards?
No, I think it's still just something from their moms.
Oh, but those are the special... Oh, but those are the best type of awards.
That is, of course, Koopa with the Q and Club with the K. I'd be remiss not to also mention VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends. I also gotta mention the Game Over Takeover, your one-stop shop to go to for geekery galore. I also have to mention Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice and from whom I steal ever so many of my cues. I also want to guide your attention to the Nintendo Fun Club, a podcast about Nintendo, platformers, positivity, and pop punk. Of course, I'd also like to direct you to Slagkick's show, Reading is Fundamental.
Yes, God!
The seasonal podcast about RuPaul's Drag Race, where we dish the dirt on as many queens as we possibly can.
Usually I'm the one who gets the dirt dished on.
Typically, that show is hosted by Slagkick with assists from myself, as well as Rob from Orange Lounge Radio, and Delvin from VG Realness. Keeping it real, girl.
Yes, God.
And I also want, of course, to direct you to the Star Trek podcast, the Starboard Power Coupling Podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail. And last, but most certainly not least, X Nation over at culturalwormhole.blogspot.com, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants.
All right.
Now, Slaggy, if you'd like to take us to a game bar.
Oh, you beat me to the punch. Game Bar is the podcast that fills your brain space with hours of gay video game commentary. They're part of the Hunty Bunch and basically the gay video game Prairie Home Companion. Hopefully the Lindsay Lohan theatrical version. Nerdgasm Network is the wildest shock jock video radio. Whoa. I gotta try that again. Nerdgasm Network is the wildest shock shock video game radio show that you'll ever come across. It's a bag of hot dicks. Over on the Voice of Geeks Network, that's vognetwork.com, there's Girls Gone Wow, where you can get a female perspective on the world's most popular MMO. And Horde House, places for all things online gaming, but never too seriously. And I guess they're not too serious about World of Warcraft these days. Seriously, boys, come back. And last but certainly not least...
You're practically begging, girl.
I just want to have fun with my boys. And speaking of having fun with the boys, it's always a wonderful treat to listen to La Palanca Podcast, podcast por y para gay gamers latinoamericanos en español. We also always want to recognize that our wonderful theme music was done by Zelda Reorchestrated, a project that aimed to reorchestrate Zelda music into beautiful symphonic sound. And we're pouring out a 40 for them, and I might have been tipping into a 40 because I'm kind of slurring my words here. Nah, I'm just hungry.
Well, with all of that having been said, our lovely and beautiful listeners.
Lovely and beautiful and handsome and fantastic.
Thank you for spending this lovely Sunday summer afternoon with us. It has been our absolute pleasure to reminisce about the Dreamcast. If you have any thoughts, theories, opinions, facts, or news that you'd like to reach out and touch us with, of course, you can use any of those channels that we gave you a little bit earlier. The hashtag GameBuoyExtra always gets our attention, so if it's Dreamcast related, maybe use that. In the meantime, we will be back in your guys' ears in another week or two to talk on episode 64 about the Nintendo 64.
Wait, I thought we were going to talk about the Jaguar, the first 64-bit video game system. Oh, God.
Please look forward to it. And in the meantime, keep gaming.
Keep gaming.
Keep thinking.
Keep thinking.
And I have dreamed a dream, but now that dream is gone from me.
You dreamed it? Wow. Video game system. I thought we were going to talk about the Jaguar, the first 64-bit video game system.
Mics are hot.
Hot mics, hot mics. Get your hot mics. Get your hot mics. Yeah, can I have a hot mic, please?
All right, you just about ready to do this to this? The Room 3 is going to be hitting iOS, Android, and Spring. LOL.
And Hello Kitty, not content to let,
wow.
And some heartwarming, but also kind of bittersweet news. Sorry.
God damn it, Wikipedia, don't take to the fucking article on actual Japanese swords. Okay. This was actually made by Sega Team.
Sonic Team?
This was actually made by Sega. Again, Jesus.
Yes, Social Links is where we hear from you, and we've. Yes, and as we launch into our Social Links this week,